skip to the end.
Welcome to episode 54 of the Skip to the End podcast. As ever, I'm Ben.
I'm Gemma.
And I'm Mark.
And how are we all doing?
Yeah!
Good to be back. I really enjoyed the last... We shouldn't blow our own trumpet, but I really enjoyed the last episode. And it seems like half of Twitter, well, most of Twitter and Facebook did, and the feedback's been brilliant. But I'm just raring to go, and I just kind of want to just get... I want to do it every day,
Let's
the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, so I wish we had the time to do this.
Weekly, not daily. People would be sick of us, but weekly would be the dream.
It would indeed.
Definitely, definitely.
If you donate us money, all the listeners out there, we could do it weekly.
But we're not asking you to do that, by the way. But if you chose to, that's on you.
We wouldn't say no to it,
would we?
We'd welcome it.
That would be good.
Yeah, indeed. I went out for dinner last week with my family. So my mum, my stepdad and my little brother. And we were just talking about all sorts of random things. And my mum turns to me and says, oh, when's your next episode coming out? And this was on the Thursday before our last episode came out. And I went, oh, it's out tomorrow. Why? And she was like, oh, I'm really looking forward to listening to it. What? Mm. Oh, yeah, I listen to every episode. What? So I knew my mum would listen to a few, but it turns out she listened to every one. So hi, mum. Thanks for tuning in. And it seems she quite likes it. And one of the things I liked the other day is, obviously on that last episode, our rewatch was Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And I got a text from my mum to say, I'm watching Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, really enjoying it. So I like the fact that my mum is checking out the podcast and enjoying it. It now makes me think I have to watch what I say. I'm now a little bit worried.
I had exactly the same thing happen to me, not with your mum and your family, but... I went home and my mum had the iPad and I was like, that's my podcast on there. She was like, yeah, listen to them all. And this was like episode 40. I was like, what? She was like, it's really nice to hear you talking and I kind of want to support you. So I listen. Yeah. And I said, it just kind of dawned on me. I was like, mum, you do realise I'm quite, yes, Mark, I know you're quite rude on there, but you know, it's entertaining and I will support you. And I said, really? And she said, well, there was one point when you talked on the 50 Shades of Grey episode where you said, he should have just bummed her.
Yeah. That's an exact quote.
And she said, I had to turn it off at that point. But you've improved since then, Mark, and you don't seem as potty mouthed.
Oh. So
she's not listening close
enough.
No.
I dropped the C-bomb last time.
You did.
Sorry, Mum.
Same story with my mum as well. And my dad as well. I'm actually really surprised at the fact that they say, no, we listened to the last episode, a good sausage party review. My mum didn't like it, but my dad loved it. And even like with other family members as well, and they say, no, we listened to it, we're really proud of you. And it's lovely. I kind of feel like a bit of a charlatan because I've only been there for like, this is my fourth episode.
It's really nice.
Riding on our coattails.
I know.
It genuinely is really nice to hear that, but it also makes me think how hard it's going to be when we sack you. I feel bad, like,
ooh,
oh,
2 weeks to the probation review.
Like, the nan and the auntie sitting there like, oh, I'm so sorry, Jen.
Oh, don't. I'm going to be like one of those rejects from like a reality singing show.
Oh,
and then
great.
We can film it.
No,
that means we can do like casting like they That'd do on Pop Factor or whatever the hell it's called.
Have like Coldplay Fix You playing in the background.
Yeah.
Oh, that's perfect. Bunch of
We're definitely doing that. All right, so this one's for the mums anyway. Let's tell them what's coming up then. So we're going to be reviewing Hell or High Water, which is a brand new crime thriller starring Jeff Bridges and Chris Pine, which I'm really looking forward to talking about. It was my pick of topic as well. We're going to be discussing the top three movies from the 1970s.
Oh, that's going to be tough.
It's going to be a good
one. Very interesting. I think we might have some overlap, but I don't know. But then again, it's a big old decade.
Yeah.
Gemma, it was your pick for the rewatch.
We're going to be rewatching Natural Born Killers.
Oh, hell yes.
Very spoilers, Ben. We need to try and let the listener wait to that section to see if we're happy with the film.
Oh, sorry.
That'd be interesting.
Maybe we'll like it. Maybe we won't.
Could have just done a fake out there.
Yeah, exactly. Mark, who are we mass debating over this week?
We're only mass debating over Christian Bale.
Christian Bale, for me,
has been the hardest one yet.
Indeed. He is in my top three actors of all time. So, yeah, very much tricky picking.
It's going to be good.
Yeah,
it's going to be very good indeed. We're also going to be taking listener questions, all that kind of stuff. But we've also got a brand new game show. Gemma, tell them what it's called, but don't tell them what it's about. I want to do some leave them dangling.
Okay. It's called Starmageddon.
Starmageddon is coming for you.
Just before we start this episode, I mean, that sounds incredible. I just want to get there now. But I'm just going to say something. You've seen our Twitter a lot, and a lot of people are drinking Strongbow Dark Fruit. I'm seeing a lot of people like, oh, I've just opened my fresh can, can't wait for the new episode, or they're out, and they're like, oh, because of you, I've just tried my first pint, I saw some tweets this week, loving it. Have we had any crates delivered to this place, the studio?
No, not
still
a
waiting.
One.
Have
still
we
waiting.
Had a, have we had a check?
No.
Nope. Any baseball caps with the logo on or
I
anything?
I can't find any here.
I would take a hoodie, a fleece.
Anything. Mm. So what I'm going to suggest now is that we move. We try, you know, we try God's nectars from other places. And we go for, I've got some cans of Magners.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
Oh, hello.
It
looks nice, Irish cider. And they've been around since 1935. So do you want a can of this each?
Yeah, big time.
Yes, please. Oh,
that's more like it, isn't it?
That's nice. Mm,
oh, tip of the tongue, tip of the tongue.
Time will tell,
that's
but it's all
Magners.
Right.
Magners. Oh, enough of this. Let's get started. Topic this week is top three movies from the 1970s. There's a reason why we're doing this particular topic. It's because we've ended our feature recently, Skip Back in Time, where we were going backwards chronologically and picking our favourite film of each year. And we went as far back as 1980. And we've had fans on the Twitter and Facebook and so on saying, oh, I can't believe you've stopped before the 70s. We wanted to talk about 70s movies. So this is our way of giving people a little bit of what they asked for.
I've shit the bed because I thought you said on the last episode, top 70 movies, so I've bought all 70 of my top films ever made.
That explains the massive book.
Look
at
all these pages.
That's a shame.
Well, whichever the closest three near the top are from the 1970s, just use those three.
Cool. Do you want me to kick it off then?
Yeah, go on.
Bang in the middle, 1975. As if I'm going to leave this off, the masterpiece, the greatest film ever made. Jaws.
Yeah, me too.
Me too.
Good.
We've all got it.
Should we just spend a few minutes each talking why we love this film so much?
I'm up for this.
I think it really is a work of genius, and we've joked on this podcast how I overuse the word masterpiece, but this is a masterpiece that both of you will both say, yep, it is.
Amen.
It's the second film by Steven Spielberg, which blows my mind. It's not like, it doesn't look like a film that's pretty much your debut, because Duel before that wasn't a massive film. This is his real big blockbuster. He nailed it. Yes, there was issues with it. It went over. The budget went over. But when it finally delivered, it was something that scared people to go in the sea. Mm-hmm. And he magically made this film with some of the best acting performances I've ever seen from everyone in the film. And I just still watch it now. And even though I've seen it again and again, it probably is one of my most watched movies. It still shocks me and scares me. And the performances still surprise me, which is crazy for a film I've seen this many times.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's the real first summer blockbuster, really. I think that was in cinema history as well. It's one of those films, for me, it's still as relevant today as it was back in 1975. It stood the test of time. We live in a world where special effects are everything. It's what is a crux of a movie now. People go and see the effects. They want to be wowed. But for me, even still watching the shark, I still get genuinely scared. It's terrifying, the way how it rips through the water, even the way how that head just bobs out of nowhere in the boat underwater. Terrifying.
Oh, I love that bit.
And that's the thing, you've seen that scene hundreds of times, but it's the timing. For some reason, you're like, it's going to happen. It's, oh, I got me.
And the eyes as well. The massive, great big bulging eyes. It's, scared the shit out of me. But it is absolutely fantastic. And there was no way this could have been overlooked in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Regular listeners to our show will know that I hadn't seen this film up until about, maybe what, Mark, 18 months ago, maybe?
You're crazy. You're crazy.
Oh, well, I know this. I know. It was back when we used to do a feature on the show a long time ago called Homework, where one of us would mention off the cuff that we hadn't seen a big famous film, and then the other two would give it to that person as homework. They had to go away and watch it. So it was my homework to watch Jaws. And I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know what to expect because everyone had told me how great this film was. It was historically known to be a work of art, a work of genius. But then again, so have many other films been that I've caught late in life. Like, as our long-time listeners know, I couldn't give two shits about Indiana Jones. I watched the first Indiana Jones film for the first time about a year ago, and I thought it was rubbish.
But how do you really feel?
and it's not the first time that's happened with something that people have told me is genius, you're going to love it, and I've just thought nothing of it. When I saw Jaws, I was genuinely blown away. I was like, by God, everything everyone has ever said about this is right times 10.
Yes.
It is as good as they say it is. It is as thrilling as a film gets. It is as beautifully directed as a film can be. And as Mark said, it was only Spielberg's second film. You know, some of the shots, like there's the one of Roy Scheider's character sitting on the beach, and there's kind of the shot where the camera's on a track mm-hmm. and it's zooming out as it goes in, so you've got that kind of perspective change in the background.
Yeah, game-changing.
Game-changer. That's been ripped off mercilessly by every director who lives since.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It changed the game, as you've just said, positively. It created this concept of the blockbuster, which has been a gift and a curse, as we know, but it just absolutely stands the test of time. And now, having only seen it for the first time 18 months ago, tops, I've probably seen it a dozen times, including been to the cinema to see it as well.
I'm really jealous. I really want to go watch it now.
Oh, I'm up for binning off this episode.
Shall we?
Now.
Should we just
I'm
go
just
watch
sitting
Jaws?
Here and watching it with some cider, because realistically, this film, I don't know anyone that doesn't like Jaws.
Mm.
You know, I actually can remember vividly the episode where Ben was about, said, Ben, what did you think? And he went, I didn't like it. And it was that one moment where my heart dropped and I thought, he's probably joking. Yeah. But within that 1 second where he went, only joking, it felt like an hour. I was like, what? What?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's such an iconic poster as well. Just that image of the shark coming up above the woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And you see it on T-shirts as much as any other film that's out now. It's the iconic image.
Yeah, I'll say now that is my favourite movie poster of all time because it strikes the fear in you. That the whole idea of the unknown, that woman has no idea she's about to get eaten like sushi. But also for me, one of the crowning glories about this film is even today, the original score is still threatening, unbelievably scary, and just gets that sense of dread in you, knowing that something big is coming. Just two notes.
Yeah.
That's all it is, two notes. It's... And of course a bit, which...
And it has, for me, one of the all-time great performances. Robert Shaw's performance as Quint is immaculate.
Mm-hmm.
Like all the little speeches he gives. So the speech he first gives when he arrives on the island, the speech that he gives when he's on the boat and he's talking about when he was in the Navy and all that sort of stuff. Jesus Christ. They should have given him all the awards, even things that he's not eligible for. They should have just given them to him.
And he's still a bloody hero when he was fighting off the big shark as well.
What a way to die.
Oh.
Hero.
Absolutely.
I think I should have saved yours because I'm going to pass it, I think, to you now, Gemma. I just feel like we've just gone, I need to reload.
Just metaphorically jizzed everywhere.
Gemma.
So, what?
Don't sing to his
You're meant to be the reason of the tone
reason?
To bring it up.
Oh, sorry. Surprise.
What have you got then?
All right. Well, this comes to no shock from the two episodes before when we did our top five favourite films. Mine is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for me, I think I watched this probably when I was about, I don't know, 20 or something. And it's a film that I religiously watch every year. I think Jack Nicholson is a work of art in this film. I think the supporting cast are perfectly casted with this. I think it's probably one of those films where the whole ensemble, everything goes right, the stars align, everything is perfect about this. And I think it possibly has one of the greatest villains of all time in the form of Nurse Ratched, who is played by Louise Fletcher, and who rightfully got a Best Supporting Oscar back in the 70s. This film is wonderful. It's the whole idea of, I think mental illness was never really portrayed before in films.
Mm.
If it was to comic effect, you know, like the loony bin or the loony asylum. This was possibly one of the most realistic portrayals of mental illness. It showed it in all various different forms as well. And with Jack Nicholson's character eventually realizing what he's done, he's essentially not trying to go to jail. So he pleads insanity to get a bit of a lighter sentence. When he realises that all of the other day patients can go as they please, they don't necessarily have to stay, but Jack has to stay exactly where he is to face the wrath of Nurse Ratched, or the quiet wrath, which I think is even more scarier. It's wonderful. It really is just, for me, one of the greatest films of all time.
See, I think I've only seen this film once, and we're talking maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So I know what the film entails, and because it's one of those that's been parodied so many times.
Spaced?
Yeah.
You know,
Spaced, Always Sunny in Philadelphia has done a parody of it.
Yeah.
It, It feels familiar to me, even though I know it isn't. I know, yeah. I need to sit and watch it again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the worst bit. I'm exactly like him. I watched it at uni probably 15 years ago, and I thought it was pretty good, but I was wasted and I don't remember much about it. And I know it's pretty good, but I always get that and The Shining mixed up. I'm like, no, oh, yeah.
Never the twain should meet.
I really do need to rewatch it because it's, listen to you, like you literally sat there gushing over this film and... I've look at you, like you're smiling, beaming, and the scariest thing is you covered probably three or four topics just in that film. You're like, it's got the best performance, it's got the best support, it's got one of the best stories, you know, and it's scary how much you love it. And I kind of really want to agree and say stuff, but I haven't seen it for so long. Yeah. I don't even remember it.
No, me neither.
No, one of the most pivotal scenes is Jack tries to campaign everybody to watch a baseball game, the World Series. And Nurse Ratched overrules him with these really manipulative and mind-twisting kind of games that she and Jack both play against each other. And Jack kind of rallies the troops around to imagine a game of baseball is being played on the TV. So there's nothing being played on, but he's getting everybody around on his side, just slowly turning the screw against Nurse Ratched as well. Oh, there's so many great scenes in it. What am I talking about? That's not even the best one. But it is just, it's incredible. It's absolutely wonderful.
I'm going to watch it. I am going to watch it again.
Yes, I need to. I'm going to have to change your plans tonight. But it is just wonderful.
It is actually on my list of future rewatches. So it is going to come up. We will discuss it in more detail on a future podcast. I've no doubt about that.
I'm very excited about this.
Come on then, Bennett. It's your topic. Hit me.
Godfather 2.
Oh, lovely.
Absolute masterpiece. We've talked in the midst of time about sequels that improve on the original, and there aren't that many. And if anyone wanted to argue with me that Godfather is better than Godfather 2, I wouldn't argue with them, because I think that's, you could make a very fair argument. I personally fall on the side of Godfather 2 being the better one. The reason for that is Godfather, the original film, was so, so good. And you look at it and you think, how could we possibly improve on that? Robert De Niro, that's how.
Yeah.
Throw De Niro in the mix, there you go, you've improved it. So Godfather 2, the fact that you have what's going on with Al Pacino, Michael Corleone, in what is, within the realm of the film, the present day, it's, you know, the early 90s or mid-1950s. You've got him working away at his casino business out in Nevada. He's trying to strengthen his power base and expand, and he's having to deal with people coming at him from all sides, the government and rival mobsters. But then you're also going back to, I think it's about the 1920s, when... young Vito Corleone, so Marlon Brando's character from the first film, you see him arrive in America, in New York, from Sicily, and it's about how he becomes the Don of his local area and how he moves up the ranks, and that's all played beautifully by Robert De Niro. And the fact that you've got these two narratives running side by side with two of the greatest actors on earth, let's forget the shite they've done recently. Let's just, you know, hold them up for what they truly are. Yeah. Two of the greatest actors on earth doing their thing, independently of one another, but in the same film side by side. And the thing that I love about this is it lets the director, Francis Ford Coppola, and the script allows those two stories to breathe. It would have been very easy to cut back and forth every 2 minutes. It doesn't. You go to one of the characters, or, you know, one of the eras, and you're with them for 20, 30 minutes before you then go back to the other one. It allows those stories to breathe, and then there are thematic links between what's happening in one era, what's happening in another. It never feels rushed. It just develops beautifully. And it's a long film. It's 3 hours, 20 minutes. And it was something that you and I were discussing off air just now, Gemma, about how a long film, it doesn't matter how long it is, if it's good. It's Roger Ebert said that, you know, if a film's good, it doesn't matter how long it is. And it's absolutely true. You could watch it for days on end because it is just so good, so appealing. And rightly was nominated for a bazillion Oscars and won half of them. A magnificent film, a true masterpiece.
You want to see this now?
What's so good about this topic already? I mean, we're 10 minutes in, but how much passion each of our reasons has got behind it. It's like, I've never seen Ben put so much into anything. I'm looking at him now smiling with so much pride of like, listen to this. It's like he made it.
Yeah. Smash it.
So it's amazing seeing how much Ben is gushing about this film.
That's your favourite word today, isn't it? Gushing.
It is, twice. And it's just, I'm just so proud of it. I hadn't seen Godfather I hadn't seen the trilogy until a few years ago. I remember we did one of them for the rewatch.
Yeah.
I heard about how good it was. It was drilled into me. It's probably a bit like Indiana Jones for you. And it's drilled and told me this, you need to see it. It's the best thing ever. And luckily it lived up to the hype. So many films don't because it's such a long time ago. Yeah. And when I watched the first one, I thought this was amazing. Everyone said, you wait till you get to the second one. The moment I saw the second one, you've summed it up perfectly. De Niro, everything about it was like, you've just done that amazing film on a whole new level.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts on the third one? Because everyone usually says like it's like The Matrix. It's like, oh dear.
That is not a fair comparison at all. Godfather 3 is a good film. And if it was a standalone film that didn't rely on the two magnificent masterpieces before it, it would be good in and of itself. But as part of a trilogy, and especially as the capping part of the trilogy, it doesn't work at all. Mm-hmm. The story's just not as strong. It's not as interesting visually as the first two films, and then Sofia Coppola single-handedly ruins it because she's not a good actress.
There's a reason why she's a director now.
Exactly. So it's fine. It's as a piece of film on its own, it is a good film and arguably in the top 10 films of that year. But as part of the Godfather trilogy, nah. Just watch the first two and just pretend that's where it ends.
Just has that sense of operatic kind of drama about it. And it's very hard to say another film's come along and it is just like The Godfather. There is no duplications. Mm-hmm. There's no imitations. They are a standalone film.
Oh, there have been many, many imitations. They just people can't do it. Mm. You know, everyone has tried to emulate the style of this. How many mafia films have there been in the last 40 years? You know, but no one has ever matched this. People have gone their own way. The Scorsese mafia films are a very different type of film to the Francis Ford Coppola ones, but generally imitations of this just fall flat on their arse. Rightly. Mm-hmm.
It's a long trilogy as well. You know, like when you think, should we do a Star Wars night or Back to the Future? The Godfather's a bit more of a... Right.
It's not nine hours, all three.
Glasses. Yeah.
But that, in my opinion, is 9 hours of your life well spent. Unlike, for example, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which is pissing 9 hours of your life away.
Or 12 hours if you do the extended ones.
No, thank you.
My next choice comes from 1978. It's John Carpenter's Halloween.
So good, so good.
I think it's one of the best made horror movies ever. I love how much John Carpenter puts his heart and soul into this, not just because of the direction, but his own score and the music, and he helps with the iconic piano piece, and his brain is behind everything that's gone into that film. He's not just a director, he's a filmmaker. I think the performances are fantastic, but it's the fact that it's so believable. It isn't a ghost. It's a guy that's just angry, that's mental, that walks around with a knife and can kill you. Mm-hmm. That's not really... that. When I go to bed at night, if I was going to be scared of anything, that is a bit more believable than Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Or Poltergeist, which is the killer chicken film. Have you seen that?
Poltergeist.
That's actually true. It sounds like a sci-fi special. But, you know, stuff like Sharknado, these are all stupid films. This is a proper serious horror that... Again, we've seen so many people try and imitate it. We've even seen the remake, but no one got it as good. And even the follow-ups and nothing touches the original in this way. In like Jaws, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I think as a horror film, you probably won't find a better, scarier, more well-directed film.
I don't think you can. I don't think you can as well. I mean, the fact he is unstoppable, nothing can seem to kill Michael Myers. And the fact that his mask is based on William Shatner, that's terrifying enough as it is.
It was just a Star Trek mask he found in a charity shop or something, wasn't it? And he repurposed it for the film.
Lifelike. With the cold dead eyes.
But the ending, you know, the fact that we think he's dead, we then have that second shot again and he's gone.
Yeah.
That just leaves your mind going crazy. And I love the fact that we then didn't know what happened. The credits come up and we're like, oh man, like, is he around?
It's just perfect. And as well, obviously the best time to watch that is around October time, Halloween. Got a few weeks, guys. Yay!
Ben's not as into Halloween. No, he's not. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I preferred the Rob Zombie remake. Obviously not. I've not seen either. I've not seen the remake or the original because horror is just, it's just not my genre. It doesn't work on me. But I know full well how high in esteem this film is held, so I'm not going to denigrate it in any way.
And again, we're setting ourselves up with spoilers. One day that will be a rewatch, I'm telling you now.
I hope so.
I will use my veto power.
So my third choice, my final choice, Halloween was going to be in my top three. But in light of recent events, I revisited the list that I made, had a look. It was going to be very hard not to include this, and I think I've made the right choice. So my last pick is Willy Wonka in a Chocolate Factory.
Great film.
Oh, nice.
It's because this is a film that I watched probably nearly every day when I was a kid. My mum and dad, they recorded it from Dutch TV when we used to live in Germany.
Oh, my Lord.
We used to get the subtitles. It was great. I mean, try listening to like Oompa Loompa with the Dutch subtitles underneath. It's great. Everything about this film is just so magical. It really is. From when you find the golden ticket in a chocolate bar to when you're actually stepping through the factory gates and he does that kind of thing. Is he okay? Is he not okay? Ah, he's all right. He's just in a forward world, bless him. But everything about this film is really just what captures a kid's imagination. There could be such a thing as a chocolate river. There could be such a thing as giant lollipops, or there could be a wallpaper where the Snosberries taste like Snosberries. Everything about this film is just wonderful. And it it makes you so happy to be a kid at that time. And now, obviously, I'm no longer a kid. I'm 33, for Christ's sake. But watching this film, it takes me back to when I was a kid, you know, wanting to drink this carbonated drink that would make you go high in the air. And the only way you could come down is by burping a lot.
It's amazing.
It's the fact there's so much colour in it. There's so much vibrancy. There's so much fun. The kids are actually really good in this as well. They're not annoying as hell or anything like that.
I don't know. Veruca.
Oh, she was she's great.
She does my head in.
She's brilliant. She's a massive bitch. But
I like Mike TV. Yeah, he was cool.
But you can kind of, as a kid, you know that the best way to... the best way to get ahead is by being good. And Charlie was the good kid. And so as growing up, you aspire to be Charlie. You don't aspire to be some snobby brat or some kid that's obsessed with TV all the time or wanting to chew gum and then become a massive great big blueberry. You don't want that. You want to be the good kid. You want the great glass elevator. You want the chocolate factory. And you want to be mates with Willy Wonka. And I've not even mentioned Gene Wilder.
The late, great Gene Wilder, yeah.
What a performance. Mm-hmm. What a performance.
Magnificent.
It annoys me when people talk about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Johnny Depp. Like, Johnny Depp isn't worthy of cleaning his shoes.
No.
Like, it's an embarrassment how bad that performance was. And everyone's like, oh, it's brilliant, Tim Burton. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. I'm not going to rip him for every performance he's done because as the Mad Hatter and stuff, sometimes I think, well, at least he's given it his take, but it was embarrassing.
It was.
The way they did the Oompa Loompas and everything about that film was, it should have never been made.
I'm confused. Did you just use his performance in Alice in Wonderland as an example of a good Johnny Depp performance?
I'm thinking of a cartoony over
Edward.
The top.
Yes. Edward Scissorhands. Cry, baby.
I was actually reading some. I forget who wrote this. It was something I read online. Someone was trying to say that the Tim Burton version was more in line or more or close to the original Roald Dahl book than the Gene Wilder version. And their argument was spurious and bullshit, and it all came down to one thing. Essentially, it was the title. They said that the more modern film is called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, as was the book, rather than Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And like, that is not something on which you can build a whole argument to say this is more faithful.
Nope.
Because when I read that book, and it's a magnificent book, at no point did I picture Willy Wonka being like a third-rate Michael Jackson, because that is how Johnny Depp played him.
Yes, exactly that.
Uh-huh.
And that is an atrocity, that film. And all copies of it should be stolen from the shops that they're in, repossessed from the homes that have bought them, and just buried in a landfill, because it disgusts
me. Or what, like Joe Pesci in Casino, just beat it with a baseball bat.
I love that, like, one day, like that E.T. Atari game will be like buried thousands and thousands of copies because everyone listened to this episode.
Yeah.
Except they're of value. When they found those E.T. games, they're going for quite a lot of money. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory will never be worth anything.
It's the one film that I remember as a kid watching, dreaming of finding that chocolate bar. And I think they did bring out a Willy Wonka chocolate bar.
They did. They did. There was an American company that did loads. They did the
it didn't get
the
you a ticket
Gobstoppers
or
the Scrumdiddlyumptious bars.
But I always wanted the gum that tastes like a roast meal and then went to a dessert. Yeah. And I always... it's the one film where I thought, this will happen one day. I will get to go on TV and I will get to lick the walls.
Yeah.
And
instead,
I ended up making windows. So it's close, but it didn't quite turn out how I wanted.
Do you know what I'm just thinking of now? I'm thinking of the episode of The American Office where Michael puts all the golden tickets into the paper, but he puts them all in one pallet.
That's right.
Because he's an idiot.
So good.
Amazing. to finish off my selection, it's Star Wars.
Yay.
It was never in any doubt. 1977, an absolute masterpiece. I would probably say it's my least favourite of the original Star Wars trilogy. Empire is undoubtedly the best film. Jedi is probably my favourite film of the three. I just love Jabba the Hutt. But in terms of kicking off the whole story, creating that universe, creating the whole concept of the space opera, it just changed the game. We talked about game changers earlier. Here's your one. Here's your real deal game changer. Anything that's come since, any kind of sci-fi story, you know, all the way up to things like Guardians of the Galaxy, you look at that and you think you could not have existed as a film or as a comic had Star Wars not come along in 1977. It was a kid's film. It was unashamedly a kid's film. And the wonderful thing about it is the people who were kids in 1977 have grown old and passed that on to their kids. And their kids are going to pass it on to theirs and theirs and so on. So my little brother, who I talk about all the time, 11 years old, he loves the original Star Wars trilogy, even though they're 30 years older than him or whatever it might be. They will live on forever. And even the shithouse prequels couldn't ruin them. They tried. Oh, they tried. But even they couldn't shit over the legacy of the original three. And that first one is just so magical. the purity of Luke Skywalker as a character, as the hero, and then you had the badass in Han Solo, and you had the damsel in distress who turned out not to be in distress at all because Princess Leia kicked ass. Mm-hmm. You had the big sidekick in Chewie. It just had everything anyone could want, anything a kid could want in an adventure film, anything a film fan could want in a movie. It had it all. It still has it all. It's still as good to watch today as it was in 1977.
Put it this way, right? I know that Ben's mom absolutely loves Star Wars. Mm. Ben loves Star Wars, and now his little brother loves Star Wars. All three of them could sit on a couch, watch this film, take different things away from the film they love. There's nothing they hate, and they all enjoy it for different reasons, but they all absolutely are infatuated with this trilogy. What other film can you say that is where your mom and your little brother are all going to enjoy
it? And my stepdad as well. Our whole family is Star Wars nutters. You know, my brother and I are technically the same generation, but there's 20 years difference. So he is effectively the next generation. So you're looking at three generations of one family all loving the same thing. And there aren't many things like that that a whole family can enjoy.
I'm looking forward to the day that your brother has a kid and we all can do a podcast and pass it down. Yeah. So what did you think of it? But it's the fact that it's still going strong now. We're getting episode 8 next Christmas. We're getting Rogue One in this Christmas.
Yeah,
and we're
months.
All like feeling like kids again.
Gotcha.
The day we went to see episode 7 together, we were literally like Christmas Day.
Oh, God, it was we were so excited.
Outrage. That's the first time I actually met Ben's family. And all I did is ran over and hugged them without saying hello. Because I was so emotional that it delivered. Because I was so badly beaten from those disgusting prequels that I just was so overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. It was too much. I'm crying now. Look at this. But, mate, there was no way ever Jaws was going to be kept off this list. And for you, there was never in a million years Star Wars was leaving off.
Absolutely. Always. I mean, from the very beginning when you get that... Dun, dun, and then the little scroll of text starts rolling up and it all starts at sort of the same sort of section of space and then scrolls down to this... big bastard of a machine or a starship, and it all kicks off from there. It's just wonderful.
That is one of my favourite films in cinema. That they do in all the Star Wars films, where after the opening crawl, you're looking at a field of stars in space, and then it just pans down to whatever it might be, Endor or the Death Star or whatever. I love that. It gets me every time. Every time I see that, I'm like, oh, I'm watching a Star Wars film now. That's when I know I'm watching a Star Wars film.
And I like it because you go in head first. You're not just sort of gently dipping your toe in the water. Mm. You're going head first.
And that's what like JJ did. We went straight into the stormtroopers about to have a massive fight. I was like, this is it. I don't care about anything else. Just give it to me.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know how to follow this.
No, I don't.
Is this your last one?
Yeah, 1976. Rocky.
Great choice.
Woo-hoo.
The reason I picked it was hard, this one, because there's so many good films in the 70s, and I know I've left some classics off, but Rocky, after I talked on the last episode, I went to Philadelphia, I went to visit the set, I spoke and we went on tour with a Rocky enthusiast that basically makes a living off doing this tour. The passion that he gave off rubbed off on me in such a way that I got back and watched Rocky again. Now, I love Rocky. I love all the films. I don't think there's a bad Rocky film. But the original Rocky is a masterpiece. It's an Oscar winner. The story is incredible. The dialogue, the performance from Sly Stallone. People rip this guy and say he's not that good an actor sometimes. Mm. And I read a lot about it. Oh, we can only do this. You've told me about Copland, which is one of the best performances.
Unbelievable.
In Rocky, and all the Rocky films, he is absolutely unbelievable. In Rocky 1, the performance from him, Adrian, Apollo, everyone in this film gives an Oscar-winning performance. And it's a film that had then followed up. I know everyone like Rocky... We had Rocky 5, which wasn't great. Oh, and then we had Rocky Balboa, which wasn't really needed. And now we're getting Creed. And I think there's a little bit too much now. But if you go back to that original Rocky film and watch it, it's as good as any other film that's been out in any year that deserves the credit and the Oscars it got.
Yeah, the ultimate underdog story, isn't it? You root for the underdog. You want them to win. And this is, if there was a dictionary with the word underdog, Rocky's photo would be right next to that word.
Well, me and my dad at the Rocky Steps with the Rocky statue would make a better picture.
He would. Fair dues. I've been Trump there.
I don't think I asked you this. When you and your dad went to the Rocky Steps in Philadelphia, did you run up the steps?
I did.
All the way?
Yes.
Jesus.
It wasn't that bad, actually.
It was. Because when me and John went the year before, I think we got up three.
We
ran up three and then we walked the rest
of
the way.
Had you both been on an all-dayer?
We might have been. We'd certainly been out late the night before.
My dad walked them as well. I'm really proud of him. He's nearly 80 and he walked the Rocky Steps. That was pretty cool. But Rocky, man, it's just... It's that film you can go back to. And I don't care what anyone says. As soon as you hear that music kick in, Even Eye of the Tiger, every bit of music, it's one of the most 80s sounding soundtracks now, but it's just amazing. It makes those hairs stick up on you. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And he doesn't even win that fight at the end. You know, that's the good thing about it. Yes, we get the other films where he does win, but the fact that he doesn't win, but you still remember him as being kind of the winner overall. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about all the picks we've had. Is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest the only one that we've mentioned that wasn't then part of a series?
Yes. Because it was a standalone film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Jaws had loads.
Had a lot of dodgy
Halloween
sequels.
Has got everything.
Yeah. Oh, Willy Wonka. In book terms, you obviously had the Great Glass Elevator, but no, again, standalone film. Yeah. Because we're not talking about the Johnny Depp one.
No, good.
It doesn't exist.
No, because it isn't. Right.
So, Gemma, have we had many come through on Twitter?
You know what? We have.
Good.
Do you want to hear them?
Yep.
Okay. So, on Twitter, at Sycamore Est Studios, The Godfather 2.
Good choice.
The Conversation.
That's a good film.
I've not seen that.
No, I haven't.
Do you know what's very interesting about that when you link it to Godfather 2? John Cazale, who played Fredo Corleone in the first two Godfather films, he died young. He died at 42. I forget what of. He had some sort of disease or something like that. He only made 5 movies in his career, and all 5 of them were nominated for the Best Film Oscar. So he made the 2 Godfather films. He made The Conversation. He made... what's the film where they put the gun to the head? Deer Hunter.
Yeah.
And... one other he did with Al Pacino as well, Dog Day Afternoon. Made 5 films, all of which he's brilliant in, all of which were nominated for Best Film, and then he died.
Blimey.
It's not a bad CV, though. You know, if you're going to go out with that record.
Yeah, and you can't lie on that one either. No. So, well, they did have a 3rd one, and it was Star Wars.
Oh.
So, yeah. Okay, so Cookie at Nicholas Cook came up with The Exorcist.
Oh, classic.
I know. Animal House.
Great film.
Your National Lampoon's one. And Alien.
Oh, yeah. See, that for me was knocking.
I know, I was very surprised you didn't have it in your list, Mark.
Was that all Rocky?
Yeah, loitering at the front door. At Ian Evans 28, Jaws. Animal House, Blazing Saddles.
Great choice.
Yes. Racial. Very racist film.
No, it isn't.
At Kostmeyer, Jaws, The Yakuza, and Chinatown. Chinatown.
Nicholson killed it then, didn't he?
Oh, totally.
The 70s was his
era,
big time.
The one.
Mm-hmm. And then lastly, we've got at Kurt Milner, Star Wars, The Outlaw Josie Wales.
Outlaw Josie Wales.
Josie Wales. Oh, not Josie.
It's a Clint film, I think.
Learn how to pronounce, God.
I wonder who'd do that. And then his last choice was Jewel.
Yeah. See, that's a classic. But
that's Spielberg.
Yeah, it's the one he did before Jaws. But
yeah, so good choices there, guys.
Unbelievable. So it's my turn for the next topic. Now, I've listened back to a lot of our episodes, and I'm not knocking myself, but a lot of the topics I've done are quite quick. They're like, what's your favourite serial killer and all this. And I don't think there's enough thought gone into the topic, so I've tried to up the game. I just wanted to make it a bit more of a, you're going to take this away and have to give it some real stupid amount of thought and probably a lot of research.
This is good.
I'm building it up now, aren't I?
Mm-hmm.
On the next episode, I want you guys to come with me and explain to me your top 3 greatest opening scenes in cinema history.
Ooh, that's tough. That's tricky.
I like that.
Yeah.
And for people out there, you can justify it how you want, but I just want, in your opinion, what makes the greatest opening scenes? It might be what gripped you, it might be the best performance, whatever it is, the best 3 opening scenes. Corn liquor tastes sweeter in this town. Could it be it's the same as the last? I swear I've seen your face elsewhere before, just as familiar as a bottle and a glass. Hey, darling, sleeping on the blacktop. Hey, darling, running through the trees, honey. Hey, darling, leaving for the next town. Lesson my set sketches up with me. Hey, darling, sleeping on the blacktop. Hey, darling. We've been to see Hell or High Water, the latest bank heist thriller from David McKenzie. The film tells the story of 2 brothers who are on the run. They've been conducting a number of bank robberies to try and raise enough money to pay off their family estate. The film then tells the story of basically a bit of a cat and mouse chase between a sheriff and his partner chasing down these 2 brothers to catch them red-handed. Guys, I'm a bit exhausted, but how I don't like being on the spot. I'm not as good as Ben, but I've got it out there. I'm going to throw this straight to Ben, because I, again, for the listeners that are new on board to Skip the End, we don't share any response between ourselves. Mm-mm. We don't discuss if we liked it or hated it, so I'm completely waiting, and I have been for a few days now, to know if you like this.
Well, I really liked it, but I'm going to boomerang this right back on you. I don't think you liked it, because I caught you looking at your watch a couple of times.
You're throwing it straight back
at me. Straight back at you, yeah.
I really liked it, but I didn't love it.
Yeah.
And I think I went in there stupidly thinking, because it's the writer of Sicario, that it would be another Sicario. And the reviews have been, I've even seen on the poster, 10 out of 10, 5 out of 5, best film of the year. It didn't quite hit those notes, but I really did enjoy it. I may have looked at my watch, I don't know why, but I did enjoy it. And the pace of the film is quite testing.
Yeah, it's slow, yeah.
And I'm not the, you know, the brightest spark. I need something, colours or something to get my mind absorbed.
Something shiny.
Yes.
Yeah. I would agree with you, to be honest. I went in with very, very high expectations. Written by Taylor Sheridan, who wrote Sicario. Loved that film. It was my favourite film of last year, so I had high expectations for this one. I really enjoyed it, but not as much as I thought it would. It is very slow. Not a lot happens, but I think it's about the very sparse but very sharp script. I think Sheridan's script is great, and then it's all about the performances for me. Some of the performances in the film are absolutely killer. So I found myself enjoying it a lot, but I can understand why people wouldn't necessarily like it, and it wasn't as good as I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoyed this. I'm going to disagree with both of you because I actually enjoyed the pace of the film. Mm. I thought the story was really, really engaging, very straightforward and simple, but you don't need complexities for a film like this either. No. It's the bad guys being chased by the good guys. But what I really liked about this, as you said about the performance aspect of things as well, the chemistry between these two sets of actors is phenomenal. Special props go to Gil Birmingham for me as well, who's real association with films is either the Twilight series or in The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. So it was really nice to see him progress with a role quite as this was seen. I enjoyed this. It's not Sicario good, but this is good.
So taking that on for what you just said there, so you talk about the two acting partnerships. So you have the two brothers who are on the run, played by Ben Foster and Chris Pine, and they're great. Mm-hmm. And then you have the two Texas Rangers, played by Gil Birmingham and by Jeff Bridges. Mm. And their partnership is great. So Gil Birmingham, in real life, is a Native American actor.
Yes.
In the film, he plays a character who's half, I think he's half Mexican, half Native American. And Jeff Bridges' crotchety old man character is just giving him shit, just giving him racial abuse. Yeah. But you could tell that they're friends and it's friendly banter. And then, spoiler alert, but when Gil Birmingham's character dies towards the end, you can see how much it breaks Jeff Bridges. God, you could tell how much he genuinely did love his partner despite all the shit that he gave him. But their back and forth, the crotchety nonsense coming out of Bridges and the world-weary resignation of Gil Birmingham, I thought was absolutely brilliant. They made the picture for me, those two. I thought they were absolutely brilliant. But that's not to say that Pine and Foster weren't good as well, because I thought they were great.
I absolutely adored Ben Foster. Mm. I'm a big fan of Ben Foster, and I think he was the saving grace of his last film, which was The Programme, about the Lance Armstrong story.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It's okay, but I think Ben Foster was the real driving force of the whole film. I would really like to see him get some recognition, because I think he plays some spectacular roles, but it's always reserved for bigger names that go forward to him. So in the promotional tour of this, I'm sure probably Chris Pine is going to get more recognition than Ben Foster. But for me, ultimately, Foster was the star of the show. He was absolutely phenomenal. The badass who couldn't really, you know, gave two fingers up at the law, but he still had some kind of heart, obviously, that was sort of held back by his brother Toby. Foster's amazing.
The thing I love about Ben Foster, he always plays a good wild card. Whenever you put him in the wild card role, the best example of that for me is 3:10 to Yuma. Have you seen that one?
Mm-hmm.
He is so good in that. And this reminded me of him in that. Mark, talk to me about Jeff Bridges. I know you're a big Jeff Bridges fan.
This is the one film where I didn't have to... It's weird. I kind of forgot it was Jeff Bridges.
Yes. You know what? No, I'm going to agree with you with that one there.
You know, when I see him in Tron, even the remake, I mean, he's had his, you know, his face exposed and all these computer generics, but I always see him as Jeff Bridges. I can't see past.
Mm-hmm.
In this film, he was still Jeff Bridges, but the accent and the way he was, and he had a hat on most of the time, I forgot it was Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
And the performance he gave was quite different to his normal roles.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't... I know you said how well the performances were for you. For me, he was just miles above everyone else. I really did enjoy the other performances. I thought all three of them were great. But for me, he was that... Just that old timer that just came on set, and every performance, every dialogue, every line he delivered, you're like, this is just the seasoned pro.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I love Chris Pine. I think he's fantastic and I really enjoyed him in this. It's very different to his other roles.
Yep.
But it was just like, there's the master. This is how to do it. It's one of those films where I was kind of really... A lot of suspense is in this film. And you never really know how it's going to end.
Mm-hmm.
And as Ben said, there's a death and we see the shot.
Two deaths.
We then see the second death, which is kind of the revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And even at that point, I had no idea what was going to happen. And the way they draw it out with the long shots and these massive open mountains, and then you just see like the way it's panned out, My heart was on the edge of my seat. I was literally sitting. My heart was on the edge of my seat. Not me. Just my heart. Yeah.
Picked it up.
I was on the edge of my seat in the cinema. I was silent. Yeah. So it was one of those ones where I was like totally engrossed with what's going on the screen. And I was literally sat there like, this is epic.
Yes. Yeah.
And I've not had that in the cinema for a long time. And I don't mind the pace of the film.
No, I didn't.
It was great.
I think that's why I enjoyed how long it was actually taking. And I think the attribution to that was the cinematography, because it was beautiful.
I've literally just looked up the name of the cinematographer.
Have you really?
Yeah, it's a chap called Giles Nutjens, who I've never heard of, but the cinematography was great.
It's wonderful.
It reminded me of the kind of cinematography that someone like Roger Deakins brings to a film, especially when he has those wide open vistas. Mm. I thought it was an absolutely beautiful looking film. Just going back to Jeff Bridges really briefly there. The older he gets, the better he gets for me. I love his crotchety old man roles that he's playing now, like this, and True Grit as well. That's my favourite Jeff Bridges, when he's just like a bit of a grizzled old veteran. I love that version of Jeff Bridges. The film looks absolutely beautiful, as you've said there. So we mentioned a second death. Ben Foster's character dies. He's out engaged in a shootout with the police up in the mountains, and that looks absolutely beautiful. Talking about the ending of the film, I'm going to skip to the end. It felt to me, the way the film ends is this. So the one sheriff, Gil Birmingham's Texas Ranger, dies, as we've said. Ben Foster's character dies, and he takes all the heat for the bank robberies. His brother, Chris Pine's character, gets away with it. He's not linked to the robberies, but he manages to get the money and save the ranch, etc., etc. Jeff Bridges' character, the Ranger, he retires, but he knows that Chris Pine was in on this. So he goes to visit him at the ranch, and they kind of have a standoff. They have guns, but they're not aimed at each other. It's a verbal standoff where they're both intimating to one another that they know that this can only end one way. And they're using euphemisms, and this is why the script was so good. What they're really saying to each other is, I'm going to kill you or you're going to kill me, but it's going to end. But the words they use is, I'm going to give you peace. Oh no, not if I give you peace first. It's really brilliantly euphemistically done. It's a very beautiful script, really elegant. But the way that film ended, it didn't feel like an end to me. It felt like the start. It felt like, and I mean no negative when I say this, the film felt like the pilot episode of a TV show.
Yeah.
I could see that then going forward, the story being Chris Pine trying to stay one step ahead of this Texas Ranger, a retired Texas Ranger who's now got a vendetta against him and wants to expose him, bring him to justice or murder him. I could see there being more.
And that's a really good point, because he's no really longer a sheriff. He can do all the hell he wants, and he can use his backhand tricks and everything. That would work. Mm.
That's a great way of analysing the end.
Yeah, that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah.
And I don't for a second think that they're envisioning a sequel to this or anything. Mm. I think that is it. It's meant to be open ended as life is. But it felt like the pilot episode of a really good TV show that I would watch the hell out of.
So Skip Scene Productions might knock all the crap we've talked about and actually do a proper serious TV series.
I'm down with that.
I've got to say something about Taylor Sheridan though, the scriptwriter. He's written two scripts now. He's written this and Sicario. Now, I would say Sicario is a better script and a better film, but this was still a great script. I love the fact that he was an actor. I think he's in this film. He plays one of the cowboys you see on a horse at one point. His main role, his most famous role, he played Sheriff Hale in the first couple of seasons of Sons of Anarchy. And then he obviously just got the writing bug and decided to start getting out there and writing scripts. And he's two for two. And his next script that's coming out is the sequel to Sicario.
Oh.
He's killing it. To think of that, to go, oh, I'm done with this acting lark. I'm going to start writing scripts, and then bang, he's knocking out these.
It's not even like he's done some crappy TV or anything to build it up. He's gone, there you go, Sicario, our film of the year last year, pretty much.
Yeah.
And now this.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a good career going for him then.
He has, yeah.
Yeah, good on him.
I could see this even potentially sneaking an Oscar nomination. It depends, you know, it's come out a little bit early.
Yeah.
You know, they tend to hold on big Oscar players until November. Time, but it's a really well written film.
It's one of those films that I've not done for a while. When I got home, I downloaded the soundtrack. I thought it was wicked. I think Nick Kaye's done a lot of it, and
he was part of the original score,
and that was really well done.
Yes,
and it worked perfectly. And it just in between the scenes where you had the bank robbing, then it go back to the home scene or something. They had this like sort of. It reminded me of Sicario, like a long sort of violin note just being held. And it's that real eerie sound when they just pan over sort of some of the desert or whatever it was. And those, I think I turned around to Ben and went, this is Sicario. It just felt like that. It really did. And it's beautiful. It really worked. But every song in the film worked perfectly. And you need to give that credit.
Because it was a very kind of country soundtrack as well. But it puts you in that world, in that moment, in that situation as well.
Perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good film. I'm glad that we all enjoyed it. I'm surprised you didn't think I enjoyed it.
It's because you kept looking at your watch. I think it's because you realised you hadn't sent a tweet in 30 minutes and you were starting to panic.
Just at the cinema. Film's still good.
So the eagle-eared will have noticed at the start of this review, Mark didn't say we'd been to our local View cinema, because we didn't, because they weren't showing it, which was a shame. So we had to go to a different cinema. And by God, they must be the laziest sons of bitches at this cinema. So something that Gemma and I noticed when we went to the cinema is, you know when you go into the cinema and then at the top at the back, it will show you what films are on a screen. They either have a really wank computer system at this cinema chain that I won't mention, Showcase, Showcase, Cough, Cough, Showcase. They've either got really shit computer system or lazy fuckers run the machine. So Sausage Party was just labelled Sausage. Hell or High Water was just labelled Hell. Why not write the full word? I couldn't understand it.
They had enough characters for Jason Bourne, though,
didn't
they?
Yeah, exactly. They're all of Jason Bourne. Because there are still people, old people generally, who will go to a cinema and not know what they're going to watch and go and see what's on the sign and go, oh, I'll go and see that. Yeah. They're looking at this sign going, right, I wonder if we should go and see Hell or Sausage.
Two for Sausage, please.
Yeah, put the full name on the damn thing.
It didn't just end there, Ben. When I got my ticket, it just said Hell.
It just said Hell.
And I was like, at least put it on the ticket. Do you know what I mean?
You
like,
literally had a ticket to Hell.
Nice.
It did indeed.
But yeah, good point. Not good.
Oh, and actually, it was a ticket to Hell because of the stupid cow sat next to me who wouldn't stop talking all the way through the bloody thing.
And do you know what? When I looked over, because I saw that you were getting angry, and I thought, Ben is cursed. Like, I could have sat there.
I could have sat there.
I let him go before me. I was like, be a gentleman. And then this woman just suddenly sat down, and I thought, here we go. Looked over. She was about 70.
Was she?
Feet on top of the seats in front of her, dropping popcorn. That's not how the older should be setting an example.
No. As an impressionable youngster, I might pick up a few habits.
And she was just making such inane bullshit
really
comments.
Really annoying.
Well, really loud. And I think I heard her partner turn to her at one point and shush her.
Good.
And, you know, he should have brought a muzzle with him because shushing her did not work.
I think if you're listening, we're sorry we didn't mean that comment. But at the same time, yeah, have some respect.
Yeah, she should have.
Do you want to have a score?
Yeah, go on. For me, it's an 8. Really enjoyed this. I was pleasantly surprised. Obviously not as good as Sicario, but you know what? I'm not going to take this away. This is a great film.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go one lower. I should have gone 8, but if I was looking at my watch so often, then I can't enjoy it as much as I thought. But 7 is still bloody high.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to give it an 8 as well. I thought the script was great, cinematography was great, the direction was good, the acting was perfect. Even Chris Pine, we've not mentioned that much. I want to see more from him like this.
Yes.
Because he's a damn good actor. He's not just the Hollywood pretty boy I assumed he was. He is a genuine actor. So overall, 8 out of 10.
It's competition time.
You sounded like Cartman.
I love that. I'm going to make that into a jingle one episode. If you'd listened to the last episode, you'd have heard the competition we ran for Kubo and the Two Strings. This was a bundle from Universal that included a origami set, not just paper, as you said.
What else could an origami set be?
It came with instructions.
Two sheets of A4.
I don't even think it was A4. It was real fiddly stuff. And a backpack of a beetle and a really cool pen. And the question I put out there was who actually voiced the Beetle in the film, and it was Matthew McConaughey. And if you didn't guess that from my clues that I gave...
And your awesome impression.
And the winner of that is Felicity Davis on Facebook, so you'll be getting that. And we also ran a War Dogs competition. I asked who directed the film, and it was Todd Phillips. The winner for that competition is Joshua Richards, and he's going to be getting a T-shirt, a money bank holder, a phone charger, loads and loads of stuff from Warner Brothers. So enjoy those prizes, guys. Do you want me to give some more stuff away this week, or should we knock it on the head?
Ooh, how many prizes you got?
2.
No.
Yep.
You're too
I've
good.
I've set myself up, haven't I?
You're is too good.
Too good. Mm. The new competition is to promote, sorry guys, this is shocking, Bridget Jones's baby.
Which we're all going to see, I'm sure.
Yep. We're actually giving away a baby. And the winner, Ian Watkins. No, we've actually got this is a good prize, and this is good for the listeners out there that want to relax. It's a spa day weekend, away day, so you get your massage and a happy ending and all that, so that'll be great.
That is not guaranteed.
No. But yeah, you're going to get a voucher to go away and have a really nice sort of massage and facial, the works. Let's put a question out there. Who plays Bridget Jones in the film? That seems
I don't know who could it be.
Who?
Let us know on Twitter or Facebook and I'll announce the winner. And that's a really good prize.
That's
that
a great
is really
prize.
Cool. But I went to the guys at Universal and they sorted us out with a one-off. So again, with the Kubo movie, they've got us a one-off statue from the film that only the studio have given to the Universal. It's not something you can go and buy. It's not something you can go anywhere.
Blimey.
It's a one-off for the studio to say, thanks for all your stuff. And they said they want a competition prize winner to have this. It's worth shitloads of money.
Oh my God.
It's literally unbelievable. And I was like, are you sure? They're like, we think you guys, your audience would love this. I was like, right, okay, we're going to give it away.
And we will be keeping an eye on eBay. Bearing in mind, we have your address, prize winner. If this turns up on eBay, we're coming for you.
It's literally, joking aside, a prize money can't buy.
That's
it's
a great prize.
It's insane. And I'll put pictures on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram.
Cool, cool.
Let's make it a simple question. Who directed Kubo and the Two Strings? Let us know on, like I said, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Go on skipthend.co.uk. It's even got our email address. And I'll announce the winner of the, I was about to say the baby, not the baby, the spa weekend and the statue on next week's episode.
Movie masturbate.
Didn't leave a pause between the two words there, Gemma. You're doing it on purpose now, aren't you?
What?
You're just
no.
making it rude for no... Do it again. Come on, do it again. Okay. Come on.
Movie. Mass.
Pause.
Debate.
I didn't think it's not too long a pause.
That's not a, that's not a sexual either. Like, you were like, the first time I was like, movie masturbate. And now you're like, movie. Mass. Debate.
Well, you know, I've got to keep it...
Come on, come
just
on.
Tell them what it's all about. Tell the people what it's all about.
No worries. So last episode, we picked a name from the Cauldron of Wonder.
Cauldron of Wonder.
It's going to change every single week. And Ben very rightfully picked Christian Bale.
Yeah.
So what we've got to do is all of us have got to come up with our favourite performance from that particular actor stroke actress. And as it's an actor, it's Christian Bale. Mm. So I'm going to throw this to... Mark, you're going to go first.
It's going to be... Shall I change?
Yeah. Oh, come on!
It's going to be American Psycho.
Yeah,
Patrick
me too, me too.
Now, this was the hardest masturbate I've had yet. That's the truth. It really is. We've done it three
pauses?
Weeks running now, and it was... Sorry, yeah. This was the one that really was down to two or three. And when I saw the social media stuff coming in, I thought, it's really tough. Because it's not your favourite film.
Mm-hmm.
And people sometimes... don't get that. It's the performance.
Mm-hmm.
This performance isn't a likable performance because he's an absolute arsehole in this film. He kills people. He's an arrogant pig. But I think the performance itself deserves every award that could ever be given to this guy. He was outstanding. And as cheesy as it sounds, you know when you sometimes think someone was made to do this role? Tommy Wiseau in the room. You know, that sort of film.
Yeah, that's the same.
That's exactly it. But there's some sort of actors that you just think no one else could do this justice as much as him.
Yeah.
I don't agree in Batman. I think you could find... We've seen Batmans that have been done differently and better. In this, no one else could do this role like him, but also so bloody well. And I shouldn't like him. Mm. I should not warm to him. I think we've talked about this film before. I love the film. And I'm rooting for him, weirdly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might be the music and the way he's...
Yeah.
You're kind of always on his side. And I don't know why.
It's like he has this dark charisma about him. It's a charisma that you shouldn't agree with. It's a charisma that you shouldn't really support.
Mm.
But you can't help it because he's so... There's just so much fun about him. And it's clear that he's having an absolute blast playing Patrick Bateman. And as I was doing a bit of research about this, I found out something quite interesting. And I want to see if it's going to change the way you watch American Psycho, especially with Bateman's performance. Basically, Christian Bale based Patrick Bateman on Tom Cruise after watching him on The Late Show with David Letterman. And he said that he saw this very intense friendliness with nothing behind the eyes.
Yeah.
Is that when he was going off about how much he...
What? I mean, no,
that was on Oprah when he was jumping on the sofa. But I can see that.
Mm.
Yeah, I can see that.
So after finding that out, it's kind of, it's intensified the actual performance of Patrick Bateman now. And I'm thinking, yeah, I totally see it.
I get it. Because the word I always think of when I think of Bale's performance in American Psycho is mania. He lapses into these moments of mania. And that there always seems like Tom Cruise is a hair's breadth away from mania. I'm not saying he's going to go on a killing spree or anything, but he doesn't. I'm careful. I'm trying to be really careful about what I say because he loves to sue.
You mean that he's that close to mania in April, WWE WrestleMania?
He's a big WrestleMania fan. Yeah, that's precisely what I meant.
He's so close.
If the lawyers are listening, that is what I meant.
Yeah. He's the one person that would sue.
Big time. The greatest scene for me for Bell when he lapses into mania is it all comes crashing down on him and he's in the office and he rings his friend to tell him to basically confess to all his sins and he's on the floor and he's sweating and his eyes are bulging out of his head. Yeah. And it's an amazing, amazing performance. Mm-hmm. We'll come to my pick in a minute. I didn't pick this, but I was very, very close to picking this because it is a phenomenal performance.
Yeah, it's funny because you say how you like his actions of mania. For me, I really liked it when he was so calm and so clear as to what he was doing. I think the scene for me is when he's got Jared Leto in his flat and he's just calmly putting on the clear plastic mat, putting on some kind of
as if
cheesy
it's something he does every
tune.
Day.
I think it's like I can't even remember what the music is that he's playing, but then he just calmly grabs the axe. Hey, whack.
I love those scenes where he's doing things like that calmly and talking about the music. So he's just talking about the best Phil Collins album and all that kind of stuff, talking about Susudio and all this. It's amazing. And that's all pretty much word for word from the novel.
It's Huey Lewis in the News.
Huey Lewis in the
it's
News
hit
he talks
to
about
be
as
square.
Well, yeah.
We talked about it recently on the top three serial killers, and that's what I think kind of made me refreshed again and think, oh, I need to watch that again. And when I watched it, I was like, we'll talk again in a minute after I've heard Ben's, but there was two for me and it was juggling all week and Ben might have picked the other one.
I don't think I have because I'm pretty sure you said to me the other day that you hadn't seen the film I'm about to pick. But just before we move on, one other thing that always comes to mind when I think of American Psycho is the bit where he's been with the two prostitutes and he's like cutting them up with a coat hanger and stuff. And then one of them escapes and he's running down the hallway, buck naked, covered in blood with the chainsaw.
Yeah.
And then he's leaning over the spiral staircase and he's spiraling the chainsaw in his hand trying to work out where to drop it. And then he drops it down and it kills the woman and then he just screams. Yeah. Screams into the stairwell. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
it's incredible. Christ. Absolutely unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Oh, and like the scream that Gemma usually gives off when we announce a good topic or
you make me sound like one of those birds from Birdemic.
I think I prefer that. it'd be easier to edit.
This is so unfair.
Brutal.
I love you, really.
Okay, so my pick. I'm pretty sure you said you haven't seen this film. So Gemma, have you seen the film Equilibrium?
I have not.
You have not,
no.
So neither have you seen this. Now, this is my favourite Christian Bale performance. Okay. There will be people listening to this going, Ben, are you fucking mad? Because a lot of people don't like this film. Like, if you go on Metacritic, I think it has something like 33 out of 100. It's not a beloved film in any way, shape or form. I happen to love it, even though it's not remotely original. It's essentially a mashup of 1984 and Fahrenheit 451. It doesn't have an original idea in the whole thing. For those of you who haven't seen it, and I'll try not to spoil too much, it's a society where World War III has happened. And so the governments of the world have tried to evaporate that or eradicate war. And the way they've done this is said the thing that causes all these wars is emotion. We need to rid people of the ability to feel. So anything that makes people feel, books, films, art, anything like that, is destroyed. Everyone has to start taking this drug called Prozium that removes their ability to feel emotions. And everyone are kind of these robots. Christian Bale plays a character called John Preston, who is a grammaton cleric. And the grammaton clerics are the kind of emotion police. It's their job to capture and kill any sense offenders, people who are caught feeling. When his colleague is caught feeling, becomes a sense offender, played by the great Sean Bean, another reason why I love this film, Christian Bale has to kill him. He then starts to kind of consider his lot in life and the fact that not only has he just had to kill his best friend because he was a sense offender, his wife was taken away and killed for being a sense offender, and he decides to stop taking his interval, to stop taking his medication, which allows him to start feeling for the first time in his life. And this is why I love this performance so much. So for the first maybe 20 minutes of the film, Christian Bale plays this emotionless robot of a character. Then when he comes off his interval, it not only does his character become emotional, but it's the fact that he's experiencing these emotions for the first time, and then he has to try and suppress them because he can't let his colleagues know and other people know that he is feeling. So it's this battle within him that Christian Bale portrays so beautifully with his face, this battle of a man who is experiencing emotion for the first time but having to try and hide it and cover it. And it leads up to a scene where he ends up coming across a cache of all this illicit material. And he finds an old record player and he puts on this Beethoven record. I think it's like Beethoven's Ninth. And he's playing it and it breaks him. He just falls down and starts crying because he'd never heard something so beautiful before. And then as the film goes on, he kind of joins the rebellion and wants to take down the government and the oppressive government, all this kind of stuff. And that's where it becomes very derivative. It's very 1984, Fahrenheit 451. But that performance of going from that steely robot through experiencing emotion for the first time to becoming a rebel. And then at the very end of the film, you see him smile. You only ever see him smile once in the entire film, and it's the last shot of the film. And it's so well earned through all the emotion he's gone through in that performance. And I just love it. And I know people are going to say this film is shit, and I can understand why people wouldn't like it. I really dig it. The other reason why I dig it, as well as the performance, is that he's just a stone-cold badass. So the director and writer of this film, Kurt Wimmer, he invented a martial art called Gun Kata, which is what it says it is. It's karate. It's karate with guns. So there are fight scenes in this film that you've never seen the like of before. They're absolutely impeccable. The choreography is unreal. And Christian Bale doing this kind of karate with two handguns. It's the wildest thing you've ever seen. The fight scenes make your jaw drop. And he just looks like a complete badass the whole way through. Everything about it, everything about him in this film, I just love. Love, love, love.
You know what? This is the entire point of this section, I think. You've just said this film is... It's not the greatest by any means, but it's all about the performance.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and I love that. And it's not necessarily his best performance, but it's my favourite. Exactly. And that's what this is all about. Yeah.
Exactly.
I was, again, listening to how much Ben put his passion and desire into that whole thing. I was the same with Knight of Cups. You know, it was a real tough one for me. You know, I said there was two. It was that or that. I got to the point where I just couldn't choose.
That's shocking.
It's the way he stared off into the middle distance for 3 hours in Knight of Cups. That was, you know, untouchable.
When I said there's quite a lot out there, let's listen to social media. It really does bring to light just how great, but also the variety of his performances. So Damien Bullock has said The Prestige.
Yeah,
great performance.
Great film,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Joking aside, this was the film that was up there for me. Kerry Jones has said The Machinist.
Yes.
Still haven't seen
You've
that.
Not seen The Machinist.
That film's brutal.
Still haven't.
The commitment his body went through alone for that film. He's literally about 5 stone.
And he did that film, I think. It was either a couple of years before or a couple of years after Batman Begins. Mm. I think it was a couple of years before, so he was emaciated. I honestly looked like he'd come out of a concentration camp. That is how thin he was. And then 2 years later, he was buff as all hell to play Batman. Ridiculous.
I read something like he had one tin of tuna and an apple a day. That's all he ate to lose that much weight. It's crazy. Scott Whiteley has put Rescue Dawn.
No.
Which I've not seen.
No. But then again, you know, if it's his favourite, then fair enough. Yeah.
Crossover podcast have put Swing Kids.
Really old.
And Louisa Jones has agreed with American Psycho. I thought someone was going to say American Hustle because it's quite recent. And also The Fighter, because he wasn't a massive performance in that, but I think he outshone everyone else.
Well, he
won
the Oscar for that. Yeah.
And not only that, what about The Big Short?
Oh, yeah, he's magnificent in that as well.
That feels wrong leaving that off.
Yeah.
One of my favourites, and I've reserved this because I think it's that good, is we had a tweet come through this week from Scott, which is at Chicane02. Now, he put his idea forward for American Psycho, but then there was quite a lot of text. And I was like, what's this guy saying? And he's put that his claim to fame was that he used to live 2 doors away from him, from Christian Bale. Mm. And one of his best mates, Shane, would hang out with him all the time. So he'd go over to this guy's house, Shane's house, sit there on the Amiga 2600 back in the day, and they would play games all the time. And I said to him, like, this is mind-blowing. And I think it was in Bournemouth or somewhere. And he said, it was just before he was famous and all that. But since then, this Shane guy has gone on and been the body double for him in the film Empire. Is it Empire of the Sun?
Yeah.
An old classic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, do you still speak to him? Thinking, can I get an interview with him? Yeah. But he said that he's not spoke to him since. But back in the day, he was one of the coolest guys to hang around with.
Bloody
and I just believe it. And I was
hell.
Like, I love little stories that come through
on
our social media.
That's really cool.
It was a tough one, this, because it was kind of both the easiest and the hardest. It was the easiest in the sense that Christian Bale is in my top 3 actors of all time, so there were a hell of a lot to pick from. But then it became difficult narrowing it down to one. But there was a huge pool to pick from.
Yeah.
It's time to mass debate again.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious to what we're going to pick this time. Gemma,
it's
your responsibility.
I'm going in.
Right. Bear in mind, you're still on your probation. Bear that in mind.
What are we in now? Is this your 3rd episode?
This is my 4th.
Yeah.
So do you want to know what we're going to be mass debating over?
Yeah.
Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, nice.
Thank you.
Okay, you've done well.
Yeah.
Thank you. So next episode, Sylvester Stallone.
Hey, Knox. Somebody out here wants to meet you.
Bad. It's such a sin. I guess I was born.
rewatch time.
What was that? I like it. But
thank you.
Nice spin on what I did.
Thank you. You know, just looking up to you.
Always.
Don't do that.
Whoa.
What are we rewatching?
We are rewatching Natural Born Killers.
Nice.
Thank you. So this is the Oliver Stone mid-90s classic. This is the story of Mickey and Mallory Knox. So basically, they are two victims that have been traumatized by some form of child abuse. They meet one day by fate, and they find a connection with each other romantically. And it kind of escalates from there. Mickey takes Mallory away from her family by murdering them, and they essentially go on a massive killing spree across America. They are being chased by a detective called Jack Scagnetti. Eventually, they get caught, and we follow their story in prison.
Before we go any further, I'm annoyed because you just nailed that. And you did a really good job. And I've got 50 episodes under my belt and I struggle. And the listeners won't know this, but we had to do 16 different takes of that one for Hell or High Water. You've been here 5 minutes and you're nailing it.
I'm
I feel
disgusting.
Like I might be sacked at some point soon. Ben, please say something.
Hold on.
Have you been...
Oh, never mind.
Good work, Jem.
Thank you very much. So... Natural Born Killers, guys. Who wants to kick it off? Because I would love to kick it off, but you're going to have to shut me up in some way. So I'd love to throw it out there.
Throw it to Ben.
Yeah, Ben.
It's a masterpiece, isn't it?
Yeah!
Let's just put it out there. Let's lay it out flat. It's a fantastic film. It's one of those that I have seen Christ knows how many times. It's got to be in the 20s now, I think, the amount of times I've seen this. And I never like it any less. In fact, generally, my appreciation for it grows because I think when I first saw this, I would have been in my early teens, something like that. And I just loved it because there were a lot of killings. You know,
How many killings?
Because at that age, that's what you just want the blood and guts,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
It's now at this age where not only am I old enough to care about the process of filmmaking, but I also somewhat have to care because we do a movies podcast. I look at it more from an artistic standpoint. And you look at... We'll come to the performances and the scripts and all that sort of stuff later, mm-hmm. But if you look at the breadth of the different types of shots that are in this film, God, so at no point is the camera ever on a horizontal plane. It's always at an angle. There's a lot of Dutch angles and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Throughout the film, Oliver Stone, who is a consummate stylist, he uses so many different things. So you have scenes that are in black and white. You have scenes that are set in a kind of fake sitcom style. Mm-hmm. You have animated scenes. You have slow motion scenes. You have scenes that have the POV of a bullet or of a knife.
That's right.
All these different things that he uses. And something that I read the other day is that this film, because of the quick editing techniques, has 3,000 cuts. An average film has 600 to 700 cuts.
Jesus.
This has 3,000. That is how hectic and kinetic this film is. And it's overwhelming, actually. It's quite overpowering how much is going on. It's hard to kind of compute it all in one sitting.
But you could argue and say that was the feel of the mid-90s with Generation X.
Yeah, yeah, it was very MTV.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the influence was there. And there's a lot of scenes that show the demon inside of not just Mickey and Mallory Knox, but Jack Scagnetti. You also see it with Wayne Gale, who we will talk about
big
later.
Time.
It was of the time, there was so much controversy surrounding it. It almost felt very revolutionary. You know, nothing had been this shocking, nothing had been this surprising to watch, but my God, it delivered in such a way where it wasn't just dismissed as pure violence or violent porn or whatever it is, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was just the fact that it was of that generation, it was of that time, and I think, 20 years ahead, it is still as important now as it was back then.
Mm-hmm.
We've been doing rewatches, obviously, over 50 episodes, and the last time I had feelings like this was when Ben picked Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
It's that out there, it's that wacky, it's that mental, that it's a film you just got to give your attention to.
Definitely.
You can't go and just pause it or go and have
you
a drink or something. You've got to give it your undivided attention. It's been about 10 years since I've seen this. I won't make out I'm this massive fan of it.
Mm.
I know it exists. I was a fan of when I first saw it. I saw the director's cut.
Mm.
And then I obviously watched it again for the rewatch. It's really hard to try and sum up with words how wacky and how experimental it is.
Yeah.
It's not like Sucker Punch where it's over the top and there's too many different things going on. It's about the right balance for me.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's weird because Ben was talking about there, like, no... at any time is the camera completely horizontal on, and some people will be like, oh, I couldn't get used to that.
Yeah.
I could watch this for another 2 hours.
Even the way it's shot as well, because some of the screen's really fuzzy as well.
Yeah, and it shouldn't work, but it does. And the black and white scenes and the over-the-top, really comedic performances are suddenly straight after a real important killing that is done really well directed. It shouldn't work, but when you piece it all together, that's mad how many cuts you just said.
Yeah.
But when it pieces all together, it never one scene things out of place. And then you just get used to it. And when you're an hour into the film, you've adjusted and you're not waiting, oh God, this is a bit weird, why it suddenly changed that. You want it to. And it's weird how to try and summarise how it is, but it just flows perfectly and it shouldn't.
You could also argue the fact that we are now within the world of Mickey and Mallory Knox, because they are two very unhinged characters, of course, from their family backgrounds, which is by no fault of their own. But this is how they see the world. They see it as so fragmented, so disjointed, that we as a viewer are on the same ride as them.
Yeah, absolutely. We are seeing it through their point of view for the most part. one of the things that the film was controversial for is, of course, the high amount of blood and gore and violence. And people took aim at Oliver Stone over this, because Oliver Stone insists that this film is a satire. It's a satire on the media's treatment of serial killers and murderers, how they become celebrities in the eyes of the media, because that's what happened. You know, Wayne Gale, the character played by Robert Downey Jr., he is kind of a tabloid newsman who does a show about famous serial killers and stuff, and he makes them big news. He films them, he follows them around. Fans are cheering their name outside the courthouse. They've made them in celebrities. So what Oliver Stone wanted to do was satirise that. But the people who complain about that say, okay, maybe you have done that, but you've also glamorised violence by making this excessively violent film. So they think he's kind of pissed on his own message somehow. I don't know that he has. I don't think you could satirise it without going the full way to show it anyway. You can't satirise something that isn't there. You need to delve deep into it to get to the satirical element. But I think it's absolutely brilliant from that respect. And one of the best parts of the satire for me is a scene that I mentioned just now, is the sitcom scene.
Oh, God.
So going back to what you were saying there, Gemma, about their how they were brought up as kids. So Juliette Lewis's character, Mallory Knox, she was both physically and sexually abused by her father, played by the late comedian Rodney Dangerfield. Mm-hmm. But the sequences that you see of her home life are shot like an old 1950s sitcom.
I Love Lucy or something.
Exactly that kind of thing. So there are times when Rodney Dangerfield is saying really awful things, basically, I'm going to take you upstairs and sexually abuse you. Mm-hmm. And then the laugh track will kick in. And it's really disorientating hearing that laugh track, and again, it's, you know, it's satirizing the whole thing, but it works really well. It makes it even harder to watch than it would if it was just, if it had just been played straight.
May I add as well, back in the day, people were so concerned about the level of violence. I would have said that would have been much more shocking than the violence is sporadic. It's things like that I find probably more unsettling.
I remember the uproar now. I can remember it being like the banned video and going into like Virgin Megastore, and the cover wasn't allowed to be showed. It had like a protective, like they're doing pornos on the top floor in
I'm very well aware of those. Yeah,
but it was a massive uproar. It was all over the news and everything. I remember Tarantino having to come out and defend script and all this, and it was like, Jesus, like we've not had that for a long time. People now try and make Tarantino that kind of Stone character where they want to go and rip him and say that he's too violent, but that was a game changer in the way, but it got away with it.
Absolutely. And I think now's a perfect time to start talking about the performances as well. Where to start? More importantly, where to start?
Let's start with Mickey and Mallory. They're the main characters,
They are a match made in heaven, Juliette Lewis and Woody Harrelson. Mm-hmm. They were born to play these characters together because the chemistry is just electrifying. It's so authentic and genuine. You genuinely believe that they're these two crazy maniacs who are hopelessly in love forever and always. And they are just... they're just a dream to be together on the screen.
Their chemistry is amazing. The thing, I love them both. I think they're both phenomenal actors. I'll watch them in anything. The thing that amazes me about this from the Woody Harrelson perspective is that he did this film 1 year after Cheers ended. So he was known for Cheers. He was known for playing the character of Woody in Cheers, who was the slightly dim-witted barman who everyone loved, wouldn't say boo to a goose. And then pretty much the next thing he did was playing a completely psychopathic serial killer in this film. And at no point are you thinking, oh, he's out of his depth, oh, this is the wrong career movie, like he's born to play that. He is that damn good. Woody Harrelson is that damn good an actor that he pulls it off with aplomb.
I'm also thinking that we don't see enough of him. I mean, we saw him in Zombieland, it was really good, but I can't remember the last couple of years we've seen a really good performance from
him. We want Woody Harrelson. We want Woody.
More Woody.
More Woody.
But also on the same breath, Juliette Lewis.
Yeah.
is outstanding, and this is her finest role. There's not, it's like, if we ever have to masturbate over her, that it would be a complete, I can say it now, that it's miles above anything else.
Dust Till Dawn would be knocking on the door for me, but this, I think this would win.
California.
But again, since those films, which are 10, 20 years ago, I was talking to my friend about this the other day, texting him, he's on watching it, I'm like, so am I. Where is she now? We've not seen her put in...
Right, do you know the last role she did was for Gem and the Holograms?
Oh, Christ.
And that got that sums battered.
It up. Disaster piece,
absolute
that was.
Absolutely battered. Yeah. And again, like, she's just... You believe the vulnerability behind this great big personality that she has as well.
Just I want someone to cast it again, like Tarantino could pick up and put in his next film as a massive key role where people go, oh yeah, I remember her. She should be back in the limelight.
Definitely.
I saw her, I can't remember what it was, but I saw her and her role, you could sum up her role as being someone's mum. That was the role she was playing. And it's like, you know, that is not the sort of roles that the absolutely kick-ass brilliant actress Juliette Lewis should be playing.
She was in Wayward Pines not long ago.
Oh, was she?
And she played a mum.
Oh, there you go.
There we go.
And it was that good, you forgot what she did.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And that is a tragedy.
One of the things I love about her in this film is that she's an absolute badass. Like, there are several scenes where she's beating the living shit out of men. Mm-hmm. Like, there's one of the early scenes, she's actually having a stand-up fist fight with a guy in a diner and kicking his ass.
The very opening scene.
And apparently Oliver Stone said to her, okay, the script calls for you to beat up these men, so we want you to get in the gym and buff up. We want you to, you know, look like you could take them on. Yeah. And she refused. She said, no, I don't want to look like a bodybuilder. I want to look like a pushover, because then it's all the more powerful when I kick the shit out of these guys. And it is. She's
genuinely
so
looks
dainty.
Like she's absolutely destroying these people. Like, and the punt, the way it's all, again, it's the filming and fair play to all of it, but the punching and the impact it has, it's not this psh, it's it's unbelievably well done.
In the prison scene when Jack Scagnetti comes in to visit her in the cell and she smashes his head against the wall, she genuinely broke Tom Sizemore's nose.
Really?
She smashed his head in the wall too hard.
Jesus Christ.
So I think the bit where he says to her, you broke my nose, you bitch, in the film, I don't think that was in the script.
There's me saying how well she makes it look.
And as well, remember at that beginning scene, she kills that guy with her bare hands. Mm-hmm. There are no weaponry involved whatsoever.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the two main characters. Come on, we've got to talk about Wayne Gale.
Wayne Gale!
American Maniacs!
It is one of my favourite performances in any film of all time, Robert Downey Jr. as Wayne Gale. It's so off the page, this over-the-top tabloid journalist. And I've been wondering for years, why the hell does he do it as an Australian? Where did the Aussie accent come from? And I found out he wanted to do research before the film with kind of tabloid TV journalists. And he went to a famous Australian guy called Steve Dunleavy, who does these tabloid shows in America that follow trials around and killers and all that. And he wanted to go and follow him around. And when he came back to America after doing his research, he said to Oliver Stone, can I do it as an Australian? And Stone was like, what? Like, please. So he let him do it as an Australian. And I'm so glad they did, because it still would have been a great character if he was an American. Yeah. But that Aussie accent, I don't know why.
Something.
It just adds something extra to it. I think it's, no offence to any Australians out there, because I don't mean this in an offensive way, but it's an innately funny accent. Like, Australian stand-up comedians are funnier to me than any other comedians, because their accent just has an innate humour to it. It's like Geordies. Give me a Geordie comedian any day of the week, because they have an innately funny accent. And it just works so well.
Yeah.
And one of the best things I've ever seen in film is when Wayne Gale goes native. So they're in the prison. there's a riot, and Woody, Mickey manages to escape and grab hold of a gun, and he's taken along Wayne Gale as a hostage. But then Wayne gets into it and manages to pick up a gun and starts firing at the wardens.
Right.
And there's a bit where he first picks up the gun and he tries to do kind of an army roll on the ground, and it's the most awkward roll you've ever seen, and it's hilarious. Danny
Jr.
It's
those things. I think, did he improvise at that time? Did he do that?
Because
you couldn't write that in. Why would you think of that? It's magic.
I'm just laughing at that role now, just thinking about it.
But it's nice, because we talked recently on the last episode on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang about his revival and how he came back. And it just shows that when he puts his mind to it, and now I just associate him as Iron Man. I can't get him out of my head as Iron Man. But these performances were just killer.
Yeah.
Like, that film, he owns it.
He does. And the bit when you do watch the American Maniacs opening credits as well, and it's absolutely hilarious. You see him like try to karate kick a bad guy. You see him look off in the distance. Like, it's really corny and 90s like electro music.
And in the sort of the modern day scenes, he's got shorter hair. Yeah. But in that intro, he's got a mullet.
He does. Real bushy. Yeah. But he's great. And the way how he, when he does his voiceover on the actual show, is like, you know, they stopped at a donut shop, like real, like proper reading the script. But it's just everything about this film is just amazing. And we haven't even talked about the soundtrack as well.
We'll come to the soundtrack. I want to stick with the actors for a minute, because I want to talk about Tommy Lee Jones as well as the prison warden.
How could we forget?
He's hilarious. He's chewing the scenery like nobody's business. It's one of the most over-the-top, overblown performances I've ever seen anyone give, but it's so good. Some of the like little dirty looks he gives people. Well, there's a bit where he hears that someone tells him that there's been a riot and he goes apoplectic, and then the guy then says, oh yeah, and Scagnetti's been killed, and he just goes, just shrugs and moves on with his day. It's so good. Oh, Tommy Lee Jones, absolutely brilliant. And he's one of them that, because he's only in kind of the last third or the last quarter of the film, I forget, no matter how many times I've seen it, I forget he's in it until he turns up. I'm like, oh yes.
Well, I was ready to talk about the soundtrack. I completely forgot that he was in it. And I love, one of the things I love about Tommy Lee Jones's character is that his hair is so finely coiffed when we first meet him, and then it just goes wilder and wilder until it starts resembling like devil horns by the end of it, and he's just completely out of his mind with rage and fury.
Again, was that staged or was it him just
You know, like, he had so much fun with this, like, that he probably just got told, right, just do whatever you want to do, and he's just gone, right, ham, and he's just gone completely over the top.
He's a fine example of where we're now not seeing him in a good role for years. I mean, again, he's Men in Black, and then I've not seen him do anything serious. Yeah.
Brilliant. I love how you've completely overlooked No Country for Old Men, but you've gone straight to Men in Black.
Because I think he did Men in Black 3. He did Men in Black 3 since then, so it's your last film's your legacy.
Recently, he's been in the Jason Bourne films as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. He was in the newest one, was cack, so, to be honest.
Yeah.
But again, I just want to see these people back in the scene.
Should we go back to the 90s?
Invent a time machine. Yes. So the soundtrack, which was put together by Trent Reznor.
Yes. Oh. A lot of Nine Inch Nails tracks, which work perfectly. Mm. I'm not going to claim to be the biggest fan of Nine Inch Nails. I'm not. But I like a lot of their newer stuff. Yeah. I think, Ben, you agree on
that. Yeah. Mm.
But the older stuff that he uses on this, which is quite emphatic, and you hear all these like real big synths, which are very, very... As soon as you hear it, you know it's Nine Inch Nails. Yeah. They're perfect. They're made for this film. Perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of aggressive and kind of violent music.
Well, to kind of counterbalance that, we have Leonard Cohen in there as well, who's got the very deep, gravelly voice, but this sort of... It's funny, his music I always associate would be great for serial killer films. I mean, fair enough, he had Hallelujah in Watchmen when, you know, there was a bit of a
bizarre scene.
That whole soundtrack, I actually downloaded it after watching it the other night as well, and it's just the perfect balance as well. You even got like a Patsy Cline song in there, who's like all good and sweetness and sugar back in the day, but it is just the perfect balance of this mishmash of music, and it kind of reflects the chaos of Mickey Mallory's adventures.
Yeah, it does. And we've done best soundtracks as a topic many moons ago, and I this one didn't cross my mind, but I wish it had, because it is that damn good.
It's one of those things that I think we should actually do again. I think not yet, but I think we should do our next best top three.
Because all right,
there's so many out there. I'd love to hear what you thought. And there is so many I forgot. Yeah. Back in the day, I was kind of just, them three.
Young and reckless.
If I actually put it back in the day. But I would love to revisit it, knowing that there's probably a lot we missed off.
Listeners, when we do that, you will realise we've run out of other ideas.
Next week. Talk to me about Tarantino's involvement with this.
This is it, you see. So Tarantino wrote the spec script. He wrote it with the intention of a friend of his who he used to work with at a video store directing it. They couldn't get funding for him to do that, so they were going to film it sort of guerrilla style on the streets and just try and make it themselves. Then eventually the script, this didn't happen, and the script got into the hands of Oliver Stone, and he decided he wanted to make it. And then he and a couple of other guys, a couple of the producers, ended up rewriting pretty much the whole thing. I think some of the key dialogue is there, but the story and the focus has totally changed to the point where Tarantino wasn't even given screenplay credit anymore. He's just given story credit. And by all accounts, he absolutely hates the film. He can't stand what Oliver Stone did with it.
I'd love to, I know we'll never get it, but I'd love to see what would have been on screen from his original script.
I'm sure they would have probably gone about 5 minutes talking about that key lime pie at the opening credits. Wow, I think we've covered quite a lot of the film. Shall we rate it?
Yeah, let's give it a score, why not?
Go on then, let's go Ben.
9 out of 10. It's a damn near flawless film. It's not quite a 10 out of 10, it's a very high 9. It's a film I absolutely love.
Listen to us, it's a 9. It can't not be. It's not a 10.
Yeah.
But in a couple of years, when we've really run out, it'll be a 10. Come on, Gem.
For me, it is a 10.
Wow.
It's an absolute perfect film, and it's been a while since I watched it the other night, and when I watched it, I realised just how much in love I am with it, and for me, it's completely flawless. So, my very first 10 out of 10.
Wow. Overall, it still only gets a 9, though.
It does, yeah.
It is a great film. Yeah. It is a great film. That's a very high score, 9 out of 10. Whose choice is it now for the next week? Oh, it's me, isn't it?
It's you.
It is me.
I'm nervous. I'm not going to lie. Because we're on a run
now.
Let's do this.
I've changed my choice every day for the last week. So I've got a whole list. And every day I come up with a new one. I think, yeah, I've got the perfect reasoning for it, blah, blah, blah. The one I've settled on today, I have no reasoning for whatsoever. Other than the fact it's an absolute masterpiece, everyone says, and I haven't seen it.
Oh.
So we're going to watch Apocalypse Now.
Yes!
Wow! We are now going to play a brand new game.
Your game show that you came up with your first yourself.
One. Oh my giddy ass.
And I do believe that me and Ben have set quite a high bar.
I know.
What if I like underperform?
You're out. As we said, you're still in your probation.
We'll document it and then we'll discuss it in the review.
Yeah. Oh, crikey.
For the listeners out there, we're going to do the review in 3 episodes time.
Yeah.
And then we'll announce live on the episode if she's going to... Well, you'll know at the start. Be like, this is Ben, Mark, and... Oh.
Yeah. Did you put through the paperwork for a P45?
Is there a HR department?
It's me. Good luck with that.
Well, I'd better get on with this game, really, shouldn't I? So, the name of the game is Starmageddon.
That's all I gave. Mm-hmm.
That's all I gave last episode, so I should really tell the listeners, you know, what to expect. Yeah. So, basically, we're all familiar with 5-star reviews.
Yeah.
I mean, we should know. We get quite a lot of them ourselves.
We do, yeah.
But with every 5-star review, there will always be a 1-star review.
Not for us.
No.
We don't know what this is, so no. I should really explain to these guys as well. So as passionate as 5-star reviews are, 1-star reviews are just so bloody funny. Mm. They're great. So the name of the game. I am Games Master for this episode. So I'm going to read out 3 1-star reviews to Mark and Ben. And they're going to need to guess what film I'm talking about.
Ooh, I like it.
So if someone is incorrect or if you pass... It goes to the next person, and they guess it, and then they get the point. So it's 1 point per round.
Yeah.
Round, I like that. Should we do that? Okay.
3 rounds.
Yeah, 3 rounds.
3 rounds each.
3 rounds each.
Yeah.
I should really be more clearer again. Ooh, probation.
We're helping you. It's all right.
Thank you. Standard. You won't help. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I would just like to say I came up with this game. Oh, no, that could be bad. What if it's
bad? Yes, let's see how it goes,
and then
take the claim.
Okay, so we're going to start with Mark. Ooh. You're going to be the first one, so I'm going to read movie review 1-star number 1. I've got a 42-inch Panasonic LCD TV with Blu-ray, and it's the business. I don't expect to have to watch black and white films on it. It's not 1978. Save up and buy a colour camera, Mr. Spielberg, you moron. Then perhaps people will watch your stupid films. What's the film?
Schindler's List.
He's got it.
That was so easy.
God.
I'm going to break you guys in first, okay?
Oh.
So it's all right. Ben.
Yeah.
Movie review number 2. Really disappointed with this film. It didn't contain any bacon. Sad face. Wasn't expecting better. We'll try Breakfast at Tiffany's instead.
Oh, Christ. I'll say Breakfast of Champions.
It's incorrect.
Yeah.
Mark.
Babe.
Incorrect. Oh. It was The Breakfast Club.
Oh. I'm going to put in an official complaint here because in Mark's one, you gave him the director's name.
How is
that not significantly easier than mine?
But I also said, we'll try Breakfast at Tiffany's. No bacon. The Breakfast Club. This is the name of the game. Mm. Right.
That's going in your review.
HR.
HR is not happy with me.
There's still all to play for.
Right, Mark, number 2. Musical nonsense, but my wife likes it. 27 years of bliss, never a crossword. And if you believe that, you'll swallow anything.
The Justin Bieber movie.
I'm passing it to Ben.
Mamma Mia.
Incorrect. It was Grease. 27 years, musical nonsense.
I thought the 27 years was how long he's been married.
And when you said swallowed, I thought Bush. You know, the band Bush, they had a song called Swallowed, but then I thought they wouldn't have their own movie out.
That's still incorrect.
not even when they were popular.
The Life and Times of Gavin Rossdale.
Ben, right, number 2. My wife wanted to watch this, not me. I knew what it would be like, and I was right. It's basically 3 hours of people who are total bellends getting drunk, high, and shagging with some typical money motivational speeches. Thrown in with a, look what I have got attitude. It is awful. Avoid it.
Wolf of Wall Street.
Bingo.
Hey-o.
And that wasn't easy. That could have been 24-hour party, people.
Mm. There we go.
Could it, was the, it was the money speeches thing that you said. Yeah. That was the kicker. That's how I got it.
See, it's all square now, dude.
It's all square. We're drawing now. So, Mark.
Last one.
The premise of this film is wonderful. The actual film is very dull. The main problem is bang, bang, crash. Oh no, we need to go to sleep.
Is that it?
That's it.
Jesus. It's a Wonderful Life.
Ben?
Where the Wild Things Are.
It's Inception. They need to go to sleep.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There we go.
Okay, I'm kicking myself a bit.
That's a great review.
Have you got the name of the person that reviewed that?
I don't, but I should do.
No, let's not get sued.
Right, Ben, last one.
Yeah.
This is just dreadful. A story culled from many a good sci-fi novel with most of the interesting parts taken out. Children, you just want to drown. And the toxic little ball of snot doesn't even die, damn it.
Oh, Christ. So it's a kid's sci-fi film with an annoying lead character. Crumbs.
That whittles it down.
Yeah. The only one I can think of is a film I haven't even seen, but I'm going to say Ender's Game.
Mark.
Flight the Navigator.
E.T.
It's a very accurate review as well.
E.T.
I should have got that.
So, after the end of the three rounds, it's 1-1.
I like that. Is there a tiebreaker? Or?
There really is a tiebreaker. I know. Well, I prepared for this just in case. So, tiebreaker. So, shall we just say, you know, first one who says Mark or Ben or...
Yep.
Right.
Says their own name.
Okay.
Easy. Well, no, because then you can say that and not have an answer. It's got to be the first one to shout out the right
Shall
answer.
Shall we do that? All right, then. See, first
That's
time.
It's even harder to
first
edit.
First time, right. So, tiebreaker. Now, I should really explain what the tiebreaker is.
Yes, that'd be nice.
So, okay, so we've been talking about one-star reviews. The tiebreaker is going to be a really awful film, but somebody's given it 5 stars. To really mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Right, so the tiebreaker is best movie I've ever seen. The acting is spot on. The cinematography is just beautiful and the writing is just brilliant. Alfred Hitchcock has nothing on this.
The Room. Birdemic.
Has he got it?
He got it the second time. It was Birdemic. So.
Well done, Ben.
Thank you.
Ben got 2 and Mark got 1.
But just so you know, I won the last game, so just forget that. This isn't over today. Is it?
It's not. We're going to be carrying this on.
So as a loser, can I be the games master next time and carry this round?
Go on then.
I don't want to lose 2 weeks running, but I want the listeners to think, perhaps Mark can get back in this.
Claw it back.
Yeah. All right, draw.
You be games master next time then.
Good work, Jem.
Thank you.
You know, that was good fun.
Thank you.
Yeah, your review meeting will be slightly more favourable now.
Oh, thank goodness.
Almost at the end, but let's not forget the listener questions. Let's start with Chase Curtis on Facebook. Guys, in 2016 there's been a hell of a lot of movies. Are there any that you wished you had reviewed on Skip the End and you're not allowed to say Sicario because you've already said that for last year?
High Rise, it would be for me.
Oh, nice.
That's a good one.
Mine would be Green Room because I really enjoyed it and I think it would have been good to have a nice discussion about.
And I think for me, Creed... I think it's my favourite film of this year so far, and it would have been quite good to dissect that one.
Nice. Straight to the point. That's what I like.
Yeah.
Next question is from Mark Burbu. Right, guys, time to test how well you know each other. You each get to pick one movie to punish the other podcaster with to know that they would suffer to the maximum if you picked that one film for them to watch. I'm going to go first for Ben. I know him better than you. And I would pick, I know his worst film is Triple X, but I would want to see him punished for longer, so I'd go with Forrest Gump, because I know that would just annoy you and infuriate you for 3 hours.
Yeah. Yes.
The one I would choose for Ben would be Marley and Me.
Christ.
For Gemma, oh man, I know you quite well, but I don't know you that well.
Yeah.
God, it's a tough one. I think I would pick Jaws 2. Because I know
so
how
unfair.
Much you love Jaws.
That is so unfair.
And it would be so frustrating knowing that you've just got to watch that whole film, how much you love the original.
That's a real shame. Oh, God. It's funny because if I choose a really bad one, you'd really like it. So it's a bit of a tricky one.
And you know us really well because you listen to all the episodes.
I do. I would probably make you rewatch Grimsby.
That's good.
It's a knife in the balls, isn't it?
I'd really hate you for that.
See?
Then what would you do to me?
For Mark, undoubtedly, it would be Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I would lock you in a fridge with that on an iPad for a day, and that's all you can watch to entertain yourself. It's difficult for me to come up for one with Gemma, because I've known you even less time than Mark has, so I don't know yet. I don't know. I'm going to have to wait and punish you later on down the line.
That's so
mean. What about Jaws 3? Straight after I've given Jaws 2.
Jaws 3, you have to watch them back to back.
Or Blair Witch 2.
Oh, no. Anything but Book of Shadows.
There
that
it
was
is,
a
then.
Terrible Book of Shadows. Film.
Maybe we'll bring a new feature in where each week we have to punish each other and then bring back how badly we were burned.
Yeah, way to motivate the team there, yeah.
Stacey Corr, I really like your podcast that you're actually very honest and said Suicide Squad was good. Everyone else seemed to be cool and saying it was terrible. Why do you believe right now DC can do no good, according to the critics and most people on the internet?
It's a tricky question, actually, the why of it all. It's very obviously true that the mainstream media wants to shit on DC as much as it can. Everything they do, they complain about, in the film universe, that is. But I don't know why. I honestly don't know why, what the reasoning is behind it. I don't know if it's because the people who work at Marvel and Disney are just nicer to the reviewers.
Yeah.
So they give them good reviews and DC don't want to fuck around with them. I honestly don't know, because it's not purely the quality of the films. I can agree with the argument that in Batman versus Superman, it wasn't really the Superman we grew up with, because Superman is meant to be a ray of light. He's a hopeful character, not a miserable teenager like he seemed in that film.
Yeah.
So I get that. People can have that complaint, but it wasn't a bad film because of that. It was still a good film. Suicide Squad is still better than people want to claim it is, but reviewers just want to shit on it and give it 1 out of 10. And I don't know why.
Maybe
I
because,
do not know.
I mean, Marvel has already established itself really well with the series of films that it's come out with. But maybe just because there's another universe that's coming out trying to establish themselves, maybe they don't want to see DC do well as Marvel, perhaps.
I think potentially it could be. I know there's a bit of fatigue when it comes to the whole grittiness in superhero films. Mm. Marvel is a ray of light in that their films aren't particularly gritty. They can get a bit dark every now and again, but they're generally quite light and for the whole family.
Yeah.
Whereas DC is going pure on noir, gritty, dark, dirty. And maybe it's a bit of fatigue and people are saying, we don't want to see that anymore. I don't know.
And I think sometimes the DC films are a bit too long.
Mm.
They're quite testing. Not every person, we go and do it because we do it for the podcast, but not everyone's going to see a 3-hour Batman versus Superman where you'll happily go and watch an hour and a half Iron Man.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's a knock-on effect. It's just the thing to do now. Whatever they bring out next, you're going to hate just because it's cool to hate it.
Well, there was already something a few weeks ago that I read about very, very, very early reviews of Wonder Woman.
Mm.
And people are, like, early reviews are trying to slate it already. It's like a smear campaign almost.
Yeah.
Just wait till it comes out.
Next question is from @BradleyBrutin on Twitter. Honesty time, guys. Who do you believe is the most overrated actor working today? I will say mine right now, and I don't care if he's done other films since where he's proven himself. I believe he's the worst actor to ever go on screen. Daniel Radcliffe in Harry Potter. He's the wooden, worst, stupidest little shit I've ever seen. And even when he matures and grows older, he still doesn't act. He still can't do it. Any emotion he does dreadfully, and I think he's... I'm not going to swear. I'm not going to... He's shit. That's just that. Just shit.
I'm not going to swear.
No,
shit.
But yeah, I don't rate him. And I've seen Horns recently.
Yeah.
I thought he was better in that.
Yeah.
But he's still dreadful, and he got paid millions, and he's known as this great guy. And no,
so I don't disagree with you entirely. I don't think he's dreadful. I think he has a very limited range. So if he plays within his range, he's good. He was good in Horns. He was good in Now You See Me Too, where he was just playing like a smug, rich arsehole. He played that well, but he doesn't have a hell of a lot of range, I'll give you that. Mine, it's hard to say he's overrated, because I don't think people rate him particularly highly, but he does keep getting cast in films. Hollywood keeps giving him jobs, and it's Jai Courtney. And I really liked him in Suicide Squad. I truly did. But everything else he's done before that, like the Die Hard film he's in and stuff.
He's ruined a lot. He's, was it Terminator as well?
I think he was in Terminator as well, wasn't he?
It was Terminator.
He's a charisma void, which is why it was a real surprise how good, genuinely good he was in Suicide Squad.
For me, it's a hard question because you really got to think about it. But I do remember to a point where Jude Law was absolutely everywhere. And I just couldn't stand the guy. I don't think he's a particularly good actor. I just think he got very lucky with a break.
Yeah.
However, saying that, he was very good in Spy last year, so kind of eating my words a little bit.
He was good in Spy. Did you ever see the Oscars that were presented by Chris Rock when he went in on Jude Law?
No.
He was doing this thing about how Hollywood, if you can't get the person you're going for, don't then get like a lesser version. He was like, if you can't get Denzel Washington, don't get me. if you can't get Sean Penn, don't get Jude Law. And he says, Jude Law's in the audience as he's saying that. Really harsh.
That's incredible. This is quite a quick one from the at the mighty gooch _. Are you guys excited for John Wick 2? I really am, because I enjoyed the first one and it was really nice to see him act again.
Keanu.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes and no. I really like the first one also, but I don't think it needs a sequel. And I think it could only be a lesser version of the first one. So yeah. I think it's going to disappoint.
Yeah, well, you know, I can give or take it, but, you know, it's coming out, so can't ignore that one.
Dawn Lind on Twitter. Guys, I'm sorry to ask again, but I have actually taken everything you said on board. I need more books. What have you got?
Oh, gosh.
I have been recommending to this guy at work every day, please read this book, please read this book, and he wouldn't do it. Mm. Last week he read the book, it was Ready Player One. I think I might have mentioned it before. Yeah. They're making a film right now in Birmingham with Steven Spielberg. It's by Ernest Cline, and it's one of my favourite books. The references in there are all 80s, and I can't wait to see how it turns up on screen. So right now, read it before it all comes out in a couple of years and everyone's talking about it, and see it now. Honestly, have you read it?
Cool, I haven't, but it's going Ben's on my
read
list.
It. I have read it, it's a great book. Gemma, have you started reading the Jaws book that Mark Lenz ages ago?
No, that's going on the HR meeting.
Oh, come on, I'll take it with me when I go on holiday.
You don't get holidays from the podcast, though.
Oh,
I don't know what you think.
Yeah, only me and him do. What
Sorry, have you been to HR and put in a request for that? Because that's not getting through.
Yeah.
There is a book I recommend, and it's by Richard Ayoade. It's called Ayoade on Ayoade, and it's for any film lover. It's just such a nerdy kind of book about, with so many film references, and the way how he describes, because he interviews himself, but he uses so many different little homages to films and how he would do particular scenes. It's just so funny. It's so great.
I will definitely read that. I love Richard Ayoade.
Brilliant. It's so good. Just, you can, as you read it, you hear his voice as well.
Oh, which is a very very specific kind of one. I just finished reading The Girl with the Lower Back Tattoo, which is a book of essays by comedian Amy Schumer, who I'm a big, big fan of. And the book's great. And part of the book, she's talking about making her film Trainwreck, which is the first film she wrote and starred in. And it was directed by Judd Apatow. So I'd seen the film before, but I didn't think much to it, so I thought I'd watch it again. So I sat and watched the film again. And like every Judd Apatow film, it is far too long. It's like 2 hours and 10 minutes long. And I've been thinking about this. I've been ruminating on this for a while. Why are his films always so bloody long? And I've realised why it is now. It's because he doesn't adhere to the traditional three-act structure of a film. All of his films have four acts, okay? So the first act, which is usually about the first half an hour of the film, is pure introduction. You get to meet the people. The second act, the next half an hour or so, is those people being successful and having good lives. And those first two acts, you meeting them and then them being successful, are the funny acts. That's where all the laughs are. The third act, which is the third half an hour of the film, is where everything goes tits up. Something bad will happen, or in the example of Trainwreck, Amy's dad dies. So that's when the laughter stops and she goes to his funeral and gives a really, you know, sad speech. And it's a great acting performance from her, but that is the usual point in the Apatow film where shit goes south. And then in the fourth act, the final half an hour of the film, it's where there's either a happy ending or a bittersweet ending and lessons are learned. And those second, the last two acts, are the ones where there are no jokes. Or they try and bring a few more into the fourth one. And without fail, apply this to any Judd Apatow film. If you go away and watch Funny People, you'll see the exact same thing. Knocked up the exact same thing. That's why his films are always half an hour too long, because he has two separate acts at the start, which most other people would combine into one act.
That's a really, really bloody damn good point. Yeah. And I always say it's a joke, but this is 40, minutes too long. Mm. Should be the full title. Yeah. But it's true. Knocked Up is nearly 2.5 hours.
It is.
And that's since it, like, this is Virgin. Virgin. That is literally getting on for about 2 hours 40.
Yeah.
It's mental. I like it and I'll always watch it and laugh. But so it's ridiculous.
It is. And apply my theory to Knocked Up. So yeah, Knocked Up, you meet the characters, they're stoners, they're hanging around their flat, you have half an hour of that. Then he has sex with the woman, she gets pregnant, and then it's all sort of, they try and make a go of it, and it's all going well, blah, 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 blah. That's your first hour of your film. Then the next half an hour is her, she realises he's not an acceptable father, everything goes bad, he then tries to make some of his life, there are no jokes. Then the final part of it is him coming back together with her and helping her raise the kid, blah, 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 blah. Bittersweet ending, lessons are learned.
Yeah.
It's the same goddamn thing in every Apatow film.
Apply it yourself as well.
Yeah. Try this at home.
Yeah, try this at home.
Bloody hell. See, now, I love listener questions, but I'm a little bit annoyed. So the people out there, I've made a real strong point of this and they've not listened.
What's
happened? You've had your own question come through twice, but I'm going to open it up to us both. But the first one from Jerry Butch. Gemma. I just don't like him reading it.
Hi, Jerry.
You can now see an advanced screening of any film currently in production. What would you choose?
Oh my goodness me, that's a good question.
I'm going to throw it to me and Ben as well, because you're not having your own, not until you've passed probation.
I've got my answer while Gemma's thinking.
Go on, you get your answer.
Martin Scorsese is currently in pre-production on a film called The Irishman, which is going to star Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci.
Oh my Lord.
Joe Pesci, Bobby Cannavale and Harvey Keitel.
Oh my Lord.
Oh hell yes.
Oh my
that is
God.
A cast list and a half. So yes, count me in.
I'm going to go with Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Everything about it. We've not even had the trailer, but I can't wait and I feel
nerdgasm.
I just know that James Gunn is going to just take it to the next level.
Yeah. For me, Captain Marvel, because it's one of the first standalone female superhero films. If you take out Wonder Woman, but in terms of Marvel, I'm very excited. And yeah, I think Brie Larson's going to do a bang on job of it.
Excellent casting game, Brie Larson.
Absolutely.
Mate, that film, The Irishman, so good. And we get Pesci back, and we talked about it. They must have listened to our podcast and thought we'll get him back.
Marty's a big fan of the podcast.
Another question for Gemma. Me and Ben have answered it, but you can have it, but we might have changed our choices. Stephen Cook has said, you get to interview one actor and one actress. Who would you choose? Alive.
Okay.
Not dead or alive. I think we had dead or alive, didn't we, back in the day?
Yeah. Okay, for an actor, I would choose Ryan Gosling. Because I think he's all right, he's
what?
You think he's what?
He's
fit?
You think he's what? Where was that going to go?
He's a fantastic...
He's a fantastic actor who happens to be fit. No, he's a very attractive man, but he's also done some really great roles, very diverse as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, from Drive to Crazy Stupid Love to the next La La Land, which looks enchanting. And for
that's what I thought, didn't I, Ben? Oh, that looks enchanting.
Oh, come on, I have ovaries. Give me a break. And for actress, I've mentioned her name probably two episodes already, Tilda Swinton, because she is just so... She's such a fascinating human being, let alone an actress.
Yeah.
You know, I'll make this happen for you.
Please do. She's an enigma wrapped in a riddle.
Mine is Emma Stone, because I genuinely love her, but also I think in years' time, she's going to be doing the bestest films in the world.
We could do like a Ryan Gosling Emma Stone interview
together.
That would
be great.
Because they're both in La La Land. Ah, see?
Actor Kurt Russell. Done.
Kurt is the king. I think for me, actor would be Bryan Cranston.
Oh,
I just love the man. Biggest Breaking Bad fan on earth, and I've loved his film work. We saw a trailer the other day for his new film called The Infiltrator,
where he
infiltrates the Medellin cartel. And because I've just been blazing through season 2 of Narcos, I'm all about the Medellin cartel right now, so I want to see that. An actress? I would say Amy Poehler. Who's obviously, she's more of a TV actress than a film actress, although I think she will do more film work now. And I just think she's the funniest, loveliest woman on earth.
Nice. We'll make a list of this, or I'll listen back and write them out, and I'll try, by the end of next year, we'll have spoken to them all.
Oh God, Tilda Swinton would eat me alive.
Wouldn't you like Ryan Gosling to eat you alive? Just think about that for a moment.
Dirty boy.
The final question comes on Facebook from Sharon Preston, who I believe is a new listener. Many of the cinemas lately around London are using Q&As and many writer, director, actors attending to get the bums on seats. I see it a lot. she's asking, she enjoys it, but do you think it's actually taking away the kind of passion for the film? And are these extras kind of killing the experience, or do you believe it enhances it?
It's funny because you could look on both sides of the coin here. You could definitely see it as an advantage because it's allowing the cinema goer to really get into the world of that particular film in question. So you really get an understanding of how the film was made, what's the motivation behind it as well, maybe find out a little bit more secrets about it. However, on the other side, it could actually give the audience member a little bit too much information. You know, I remember back in the day of being a kid where you go into a film and you know nothing about it. There was no such thing as the internet. There was no such thing as leaks. You're going into it with a 2 or 3 word paragraph of a synopsis and then enjoying the film for what it was. So it's a double-edged sword, I suppose. Personally, I like the idea of being invited into the world of the film. So I suppose part of me sees it more as an advantage.
Yeah, I would say it was an advantage. It depends when it is. I wouldn't like the idea of someone doing a Q&A pre-film,
no.
Post-film. If you watch the film first and then they do it, to me that's like the director's commentary.
Definitely.
So I think that works. I'm more for that.
Mm. Yeah, and no, I think places like the Prince Charles Cinema, right? Being serious, they are still going. They're still getting to show films like Alien. If it means also putting on Shaun the Dead and getting Edgar Wright there, and it makes enough money for them to keep going for the whole year and being able to do an independent cinema, which, let's be honest, there's nothing now. It's all View or Cineworld or all these cinemas. Whatever they need to do to get bums on seats, keep doing it, because I want to be able to still go to the cinema and watch Clockwork Orange, go and watch Apocalypse Now on the big screen.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Whatever we can do.
Yeah.
When I went recently to see Kevin Smith do a Q&A, he actually did a little bit before the film, but only a bit, nothing spoiler. But after the film, it was really good because people, after saw Yoga Hoser, could put their hand up and ask questions about the film, and I like that.
Kevin, why the fuck did you make this? Kevin, what were you thinking? Kevin, are you ever going to make a good film again? Kevin, how much do you weigh?
Oh, dear.
Oh, you are an arsehole.
With the Prince Charles Cinema, they are incredible for doing that. And they usually do stuff every month, don't
Come
they?
Come on, plug who you saw there. Just to end this segment.
All right, then. I went to The Room and Tommy Wiseau did a Q&A before the screening.
Before, Ben. See, that's before. If he does it before, then that's
then
the way it's
fine. Absolutely.
And you don't need to worry about it afterwards, but that was incredible. So for those reasons...
Yes, every time.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Keep your questions coming in. We have so much fun doing them. The best way to get them across to us is on Twitter or Facebook. I read the address out by now. You know what it is. Go on, skip to end.co.uk and the link's on there. And we'll answer a whole bunch of new questions in 2 weeks' time.
So that brings us to the end of another episode of the Skip to the End podcast. Now, I want to keep this outro short and snappy because I want to go and watch Apocalypse Now. I specifically want to watch the Redux version. So we're all going to watch the Redux version.
Yeah, let's do it.
Which
let's
is how long? 3.5 hours?
Over. Yeah. I think it's a long one.
So I wanna,
minimum.
I want to get a jump on that now. And I want to watch the documentary about the making of it, that Heart of Darkness. So.
Yeah.
I think you should watch the cinema release as well to see what was different.
Shall
I? Yourself. Just do
and
it.
I'm going to watch the Community episode where they parodise Heart of Darkness. Yeah.
So anything even remotely linked to Apocalypse Now we're watching.
Simpson episodes, anything like that.
Exactly, that's why we've got to keep it short and sweet. So what are we going to review next week, Mark?
Magnificent Seven, the brand new remake. I believe it's got good old Chris Pratt and many other good actors, and it's people are saying it's really good.
Sarcasm.
So I'm looking forward to that.
So will it be the Magnificent Seven or the Absolute Shite Seven? Find out in 2 weeks. It was my pick for the rewatch. So as I've said, we're going to watch Apocalypse Now, the Redux version. So everyone out there in listener land, please do the same. Let us know your thoughts on Twitter, Facebook, etc. Gemma, we're going to play the second round of your game show. What's it called and how does it work?
Starmageddon. And basically, we're going to give out 1-star reviews and the others have to guess exactly what film we're talking about.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to be the games master.
Mark is the games master. Mark, it was your pick for the topic next time around. What we got?
It's a big one. It's the top 3 opening scenes in cinema history. That is huge.
It's going to take a lot of work.
And I want a real big justification. Like, oh, Blade, why? It's good. Yeah, it's going to be a real full-on why it is in your top 3 greatest ever.
We'll do it.
We're also going to be mass debating over Sylvester Stallone, so picking our favourite performances from him. We'll also be taking listener questions, giving away great prizes, all the usual banter and malarkey you expect from us.
Indeed.
Wow. Yeah?
Yeah.
See you in 2 weeks.